members of the call were planning to go a number of countries through which the Zambezi River goes past. Zimbabwe, Zambia, and Mozambique. We also thought of visiting Botswana as well, but we're still in the process of finalizing that. We had felt that with the consistent occurrence of flooding in our region, it's important that we as members of parliament take the initiative to talk to our counterparts about what the problem is and what we can do about it, and whether is there no possibility of changing this disadvantage to an advantage, to look at options of capturing the water, etc. So that was one thing that we thought we could lead us on a discussion on. The second one is that South Africa has got enormous reserves of coal. And in the context of the debate on climate change, we have got to see what can we do about this abundant resource. Is there anything we can do about capturing it, etc. In this regard, the portfolio committee will also be going to Australia, which I think is one of the most advanced countries with the technology on carbon capture and storage. So in that regard, we felt also that as people who are specialists in these areas, maybe they could talk to us and talk us through some dimensions of this question. So with that, I'd like to welcome all of them. I suppose you send them on you added to the delegation. Or is it Mr. Berger?
Yeah, it's me.
Okay. So you've got an advantage or something. You see him a lot on television, so we assume.
Oh, yeah.
So, with that, I'll hand over to you, and then you can help us prove the delegation, maybe introduce them, and then point them out on the sequence of your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, on the request of the Portfolio Committee, we have assembled four presentations. And before I tell you all about our presentation, let me just introduce you the delegates that you see here with us. On my right-hand side, we've got our senior manager in forecasting. I think he's well known to most of us. It's Ndabambi Mnikeli. And he will be taking us to one of the projects that we're planning to launch or to operationalize in the SADC country. It's a severe weather forecasting demonstration project. And on my left is Professor Lawrence Dube. He will be taking us through a presentation on the carbon storage. I must admit that the South African Weather Service is a specialty that do not reside in our organization, but then we thought that we could not come to this committee without, you know, doing some literature research and finding what's there. So if you're really looking for the experts in this, I'll suggest that you consider asking the Department of Mineral and Energy. But then we did make up some presentation, which I think it will be informative. And next to Professor Dube is my colleague Eugene Pullman. He will be doing a presentation on SADC, flooding in SADC. He is the senior manager in predictive research. And I think I didn't mention Professor Lawrence Dube is the senior manager in climate service. So anything related to climate change issues and what, he's dealing with that in our organization. And next to Eugene Pullman is our colleague, Mr. Ernest Bunker. He is the chief scientist or senior scientist at our monitoring site here in Cape Point. He'll be talking to greenhouse gases. So it's one of those sites that we really proud of ourselves as South Africans to be one of the 24 in the whole world and one of the best. So he'll be talking about all the greenhouse gases that are in the atmosphere. So the presentation will first kick start with Michele giving us a 10-minute presentation, and thereafter will be followed by Eugene. So that part we should complete the flooding part in SADC. and then we then move to the second part that talks to the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and thereafter the capturing thereof, the study that we presented. With that, I'll ask Michele to take us through the presentation.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. As you heard, mine will be just about 10 minutes, but the main important part of it is the severe weather forecasting demonstration project. This is the project of the World Meteorological Organization, but it is being operated from South Africa through the South African Weather Service, because we are the regional specialized meteorological center for the region, as delegated by the World Meteorological Organization. I just want to talk on the application of weather forecasting, because you cannot have floods if you don't have rain first, and then you don't want the rain to land without you knowing that it is coming. So that's how they are related. The application of weather forecast information to the benefit of society and economy at large is quite diverse, more especially if you look at our region, Southern Africa. For example, due to its mixture of mostly developing and a few developed areas, you'll find that some people, because if you have to apply weather, it has to be disseminated, it has to reach the people. Some can easily get it through the internet, and there's a lot of information, more details through the internet. But some people are somewhere in the remote areas. Some can even hardly get the radio signal. So that's why it is a bit complex. So we need to be creative get a more effective way of getting the application of weather forecasting. The significant impact that the tropical cyclone Helene, I think that it was in 2005 year, which was this year, had on the rural communities in Mozambique, which is one of the countries of interest, is a telling example. The 5 year and the Helene occurred on the same month, which is February, that's different years. The 5 year, which I would like to talk more about of this year, occurred on the arrived in Mozambique on the 22nd of February this year. South Africa held an emergency meeting 3 days before the tropical cyclone Faisal land in Mozambique, and this was a historic meeting. The South African Weather Service initiated a meeting through the National Disaster Management Center, which coordinated a meeting of all the departments that are involved with emergency services. And then we presented to this interdepartmental meeting on the 20th of February 2007, this year. The tropical cyclone was expected on the 22nd. After briefing all the departments, and everybody understood that there's a good chance that a tropical cyclone will arrive in Mozambique, then the department decided that we must be on standby. For an example, the Department of Health had 30 personnel on standby. The Defense Force also was on standby. And then the Department of Foreign Affairs was requested to contact Mozambique that they must start now to request for assistance prior to the occurrence. What I'm trying to emphasize that is that South Africa, from its side, in terms of supporting the neighboring country, did its best, and it was even more proactive than the country that is going to be affected. Usually, such emergency meetings are held after the disaster has been experienced. So this year, it was the first time that such an emergency meeting has been called prior to the occurrence of the disaster. The weather forecasting challenges in the region, just to highlight a few, some well-developed regions, industries and communities benefit significantly through the use of the weather forecast products, because they understand and can interpret the products effectively and then benefit by applying them. Important in this context, it is also the fact that the technical capabilities of water service in the region, we've got 14 countries in this region, are quite diverse. South Africa is fortunate enough to have a small but technically well-developed weather service. This is one of the reasons why it has been appointed by the World Meteorological Organization to be the regional specialized meteorological center. So this is also why it is hosting this regional severe weather forecasting demonstration project that I will talk to later. However, the majority of the other weather services, they lack some financial resources to establish sophisticated systems like the weather radars, numerical models, or even the proper data communication links in few cases. While we were running this severe weather forecasting demonstration project, some countries in the regions were challenged because they could not get the information that we placed for them in the internet. Or some, it will take time to get it. Hence, it could not be used as a forecast. When they get it, it's already too late. I can mention Madagascar as the one that was experiencing more difficulties. The weather warnings. We need to understand these warnings, so I think this is also the information that can help the honorable members as they try to look at the flooding aspect of this tour. The weather warnings are helpful if they are received and they are interpreted appropriately, and then there's action that is taken. So one of the challenges in the region is the understanding of the warning. It starts with the probabilities. We've got various interpretations from people. They don't understand it. So the region now needs to promote awareness as the first focus area so that the warning can be helpful, people can be able to take action, they can benefit from this warning. The dissemination of warnings to remote areas for safety of life and property is another challenge. The warnings are issued, but how many people are being reached in the region? So one of the things that were being addressed by this severe weather forecasting demonstration project was the integration of structures within the project that are involved with the disaster management methods. That means now for these different countries that are involved, it's five countries at the moment. It's Botswana, it's Mozambique, Tanzania, Zimbabwe, and Madagascar. Their disaster management structures are also involved. They also give feedback to us in South Africa as to how the warning were used, were they useful. But the feedback is not coming as much as we wanted. So we're trying to get another strategy now of getting more feedback from participating countries. So we need an understanding of historic exposure to weather hazards. South Africa is also benefiting now because we understand more of the topography of these countries because we are giving the guidance forecast. I think that is a very important contribution to the SADC countries by South Africa. So it's not only concentrating on South Africa, which is also big enough and is also diverse, is also got big remote areas as well. The countries in SADC are being encouraged to bring media close to ensure emphasis on the effective dissemination of this focus so that it can reach as many people as possible. This year, South Africa has enhanced the initiatives that were started late last year. Four provinces now have received some training. The media has been used. The focus is on media. And then the disaster management structures are also coming in as stakeholders. What is encouraging now, the media has agreed that it will help to educate the people because media can reach millions of people within seconds. Then we are trying to share this with the SADC countries so that it should spread to the rest of the region. Meteorological centers need to ensure single authoritative source of the warning in their countries. The World Meteorological Organization is giving the countries the necessary support. Now we've got some private people trying to give weather forecasts, but it's more for the commercial benefit. Internationally, it was agreed that there should be a single authoritative voice or source of the warnings. Because if you've got, you receive warnings from different directions, and they are also different, then the public will be confused. They won't know which one to believe. In supporting the region, then we need to be supporting each other so that this objective, which is important, is achieved. Timely dissemination of the warning, that means they must arrive in time. They do arrive in time in some users, but in some users, they don't arrive in time. So that means the integration needs to be enhanced. The different departments, the different structures, they need to work together. So we need to integrate. We need integration of warnings to broader socio-economic system that takes into account the diversity, for example, the cultural isolation and also political. Now I'm coming in to this severe weather forecasting demonstration project. This is one of the projects of WMO that are going to roll over all over the world. But this is the first one that has started. They call it now the region in terms of WMO terminology. It's the Southeastern Africa region. In line with the country's international obligations under the World Meteorological Organization Convention, South Africa has been engaged in a number of regional cooperation projects, which include meteorological training of weather service personnel from other SADC countries. I think now, as we speak, we've got about 13 students from Tanzania. They are being trained in meteorology here in Pretoria. The enhancement of regional data communication, guidance and support of WMO Severe Weather Forecasting Demonstration Project for the region, which is the most important one, and I think it's making history international. The project is operated from South Africa in fulfilling roles of the regional specialized meteorological center. Officially, you will see in the WMO books, is referred to as RSMC Pretoria. So that means Regional Specialized Meteorological Center, Pretoria. The objectives of the severe weather demonstration project were compiled by the Commission for the Basic Systems. This is the Commission of the World Meteorological Organization. The objectives are to improve the ability of the national meteorological centers to forecast severe weather events. Secondly, to improve the lead time of alerting these events. That means there should be more time given to the people to be able to react on these severe weather events. To improve interaction of these national meteorological centers with the disaster management civil protection authorities before the severe weather event and also during the severe weather event and also after the severe weather event. To identify gaps and areas for improvement and also to improve the skill of products from global centers through the feedback from the national meteorological centers. The gaps have already been identified, so the way forward now is still finding ways of addressing the gaps by all the countries. But in identifying the gaps, it was not only confined within SADC, that has been has received international participation. The achievement of this project within the SADC so far, the project management team met in Maputo on the 27th February this year, and then it ended on the 2nd of March this year. The timing of the meeting was good because it was after the Tropical Cyclone Fiveyo has landed in Zimbabwe and Mozambique, and also we have to demonstrate as to how we have given the guidance in terms of forecasting rainfall coming out of that tropical cyclone. The project progress was evaluated, and the team from all over the world were satisfied that the project is a success, hence a recommendation that the project should become operational and be extended to all southern countries. I think that's what Dr. Mpeta also has mentioned, is that it is now going to become operational. That means now we are it has to go to the SADC structure. The forecast of Tropical Cyclone 5-year being the most successful high impact weather forecast with 5-day lead time before the occurrence, it was regarded as the most impressive achievement because it was also part of the project. I must say, in South Africa, we are not the official center that is focusing the track of the tropical cyclones. Our role here was to focus the heavy rain part of the tropical cyclone. The official center is La Reunion. In this case, the La Reunion was focusing the track of the tropical cyclone, and 5 days before the occurrence, their forecast was different to our forecast because the heavy rain that we were forecasting was coming from the tropical cyclone. The track of the tropical cyclone that they were forecasting, it was supposed to also be in line with the heavy rain that we were forecasting. Because the tools that were being used, they were not really seeing the same. I think we were fortunate when we were looking at the probability of the tropical cyclone coming to Mozambique, we chose the right track, whereas the initial focus from the land reunion was showing that the tropical cyclone is not going to reach Mozambique. It's going to move south before it reaches Mozambique. And then they catch up with us, I think, 3 days before the tropical cyclone arrived. That's why it was seen as quite an achievement. The feedback from the civil protection authorities of various participating countries, as I mentioned, Botswana, Tanzania, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and Madagascar, expressed usefulness of this severe weather guidance forecast that is coming from South Africa. Hence, this activity now will be official and will be part of the SADC structure after November 2007. That means now it has to come now to the high level, to the ministerial level, not now, the South African Weather Service will still maintain the operation part, but now if it's coming to SADC structure, then our minister will have to be involved and will have to drive it. This is just an example of the guidance focus that we issue. This project was looking mainly on areas of heavy rain and areas of damaging wind. Then you see we'll draw the boundaries like this and we'll send a product like this to these 5 countries. Then when they receive this product, they will further look at it and if they will use it to downscale their forecast. They know their small areas, then they will relate to their topography and produce their final product out of it. This is just an example of the satellite that we had in 2000 when we had a tropical cyclone Eline. On your right hand side in the top there, it's a tropical cyclone Eline. I just want to compare that with the following slide. Now this is the latest satellite, meteors of second generation. Here, if you notice, we see more details than we saw during the time of the tropical cyclone Eline. We even see the small thunderstorm clouds that are developing, and also the structure of the tropical cyclone itself is more clear because the resolution is high. So that means now, if we compare now where we were in 2000.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Sorry for that one. This one is the one of 2000. So what I'm trying to say now, because we've got the higher resolution, we can see now more detail. This particular one is also helping in forecasting severe weather that we can predict within an hour. So that is the eye of the tropical cyclone now, the recent one, Fibro. Then this is the land. So here is Mozambique. So now it was very close to Mozambique. So you might think the eye is there, but we get heavy rainfall at the edge of it. So that means, that's why during the time of the tropical cyclone Eline, our Limpopo province also and the northern part of Mpumalanga received heavy rain. Although the tropical cyclone itself was to the north of South Africa, but this edge can carry a lot of water and cause a lot of damage and flooding. This is what the track that was predicted for the tropical cyclone. The first one, 5 feet before, the track was predicted to come this way and turn to the south. But at that time, South Africa already was giving heavy falls for Mozambique. So that's how we have differed. This is also the information from the satellite. If you see these red dots, it's showing areas where you've got fire. This is not clouds. This is actually the plume from the smoke from the fire. These are the recent fires that hit the Mpumalanga recently, and a lot of damage was caused. What I would like to show the honorable members is that the warning for the conditions conducive for the fires was stretching like this and like this. And actually these areas were covered. And we had a special wedding for this area, that the conditions would be very dangerous because we expected the wind to gust to close to 100 kilometers per hour. So such information was issued 3 days prior to the occurrence. So that means that the warnings are there, they are accurate, but now what we need to focus on now that these warnings be used effectively. The date of this, I think so, but they were a week or so. Do you remember it? I'm sorry, it's very recent, I don't remember the date. I might remember before we finish here. It is this year, within the last 3 weeks. Yes, very recent. It's when we had a dangerous fire in this area. It was quite covered on the media. Yes. And then this is the picture of the fire that we experienced. But what is important that this was predicted 3 days prior to the occurrence. So that means if people were really aware what to do and what not to do, so they wouldn't have been careless so that the fire starts, because they would know that if the fire is starting, it's not going to be controllable because gusty winds are expected. This is also a satellite, it's just also another way of demonstrating this fire. But what is also important about this is that the technology that we have now, satellites from above, the resolution is so high that we can see these details. We can tell where the fires are. You predict them that they are okay, then you can now say they are occurring there. Whereas previously we were depending on people that are there, maybe to phone us and tell us there are fires occurring. So we don't have to be there now. You are still sitting in the office, but you know. Thank you, honorable members.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ndamani, for a very exciting presentation. Dr. Tepia, you can direct us.
Yeah, now
we'll receive all the presentations and then we'll take questions afterwards.
We'll now move over to the flooding presentation by Eugene Pullman.
Thank you, Chairman, for this opportunity. What I would like to do is the outcome of my presentation would be basically, as I put here on the board, I will start off with a global perspective of floods as disasters, and then I'll zoom into the flooding situation in Sadek. I'll look into some historical patterns, what is the tendencies, the trends up to now, and where does it happen really? And then we will look a bit into the future, what's being projected for the future, and then looking at the status of flood forecasting study, because that is a critically important aspect of any actions on floods, and then a bit on the way forward also and some solutions. Now, if we look at the global perspective of floods as disasters, I think we first need to define what is being meant by a disaster, flood disaster, in terms of how it's been captured in the databanks internationally. And what they've done is they've basically identified a flood disaster as one where less than or more than 10 people died due to the floods, or more than 100 people are affected in terms of being injured or has to move away, or where a country has declared a disaster in terms of floods. If one of those three has been met, then that will be regarded as a flood disaster and it will be captured in the databases internationally. I also have to mention this start to find data on this kind of thing is very difficult. Luckily there are quite an important database developed in Belgium that we can use that capture information on disasters generally. And that's also the one that I used in this particular case. So if we look at the number of at the disasters worldwide, but in this case particularly flood disasters, and the number of floods by country from 1974 to 2003 from this database, we can see that there are basically three categories of flooding as we mentioned over there. Countries with, in the yellow with less than 15 floods, in the middle category 16 to 60 floods, and then the top category more than 60 floods. And those flood disasters are typically in areas in the Southeast Asia areas where they really receive a lot of flooding problems. As we speak now again, there's a tropical cyclone that's hitting China with flooding over there. There's been flooding in the whole of Bangladesh at this stage and so forth. South Africa and Southern Africa falls in this middle category, and you can see it basically is the south and southeastern parts of the subcontinent that's the largest hit by flooding disasters from 1974 to 2003. So from this, it's definitely clear that flooding is a big problem for the southern and eastern parts of Africa also, comparable to, for example, what's happening in Europe and other parts of Australia and so forth. So floods are worldwide a major hazard. It's a big problem. It, on average, it causes the death of about 7,000 people worldwide on average. 30 events per year, it could be more. The WMO, the World Meteorological Organization, they said of all natural hazards, floods has the greatest damage potential. Over one third of the total damage of natural hazards are caused by floods. Even though earthquakes are severe, they are not as often as floods are worldwide. So flood is really the big problem. They also affect the greatest number of people. Over two-thirds of people that are affected by natural disasters are affected by flood disasters internationally. And the scary part is that the impact is increasing rapidly worldwide. So that's it is definitely a big problem. If you look at this slide, you can see this is the frequency of flood disasters worldwide, and starting from 1900 over here, moving up to about 2005, 2006, approximately there. And what you can see here is an increase in flooding events and a rapid increase in the last couple of years, actually, in the number of flooding events internationally. And that is part of the problem that's being experienced currently. Now, sure, just go back to that. One of the reasons could be the increased or better reporting of floods. But since the 70s, 80s, that's not really been the issue again. And we will get into a couple of reasons why this increase in flooding has occurred internationally. What's the impact of flooding on developing countries? That's important for us in this case. Developing countries are more vulnerable. they are socially and economically far more vulnerable than developed countries. And also, they've got reduced coping mechanisms, particularly in the rural areas. There's an equation that's been used in disaster management where they say that disaster risk equals the hazard, which in this case is flooding, multiplied by vulnerability. So if the vulnerability increases, the risk will increase. And that's the problem in developing countries. The vulnerability is so far more in developing countries that therefore the disaster risk is so much more. And as we know, rural people are most vulnerable because they actually only live off their immediate surroundings, whereas people in a city like London will actually, their living environment comes from all over the world in a way, the products and what they need to live on. But the people in rural environments live from the land around them, so they are far more vulnerable in this case. And therefore, it's no wonder that 95% of the deaths that occurred due to flooding occurred in least developing countries. And for SADC, eight of the SADC countries are under this category of least developing countries according to the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP. And that includes Mozambique and Zambia that you intend to visit also. So it is definitely a problem for SADC. So if you look at flooding in SADC, some historical patterns, as I mentioned, historically, it appears that the southern and eastern parts of southern Africa are really the most hit by flooding. And that's basically caused by, in the summer, mostly tropical weather systems that move from the east into the subcontinent. These can be tropical cyclones that hit Mauritius and Madagascar particularly, and also Mozambique. But also other tropical systems that move from the east over the west, maybe situated over Botswana, and then causing a lot of flooding in this part. And that's exactly what happened last year in January and February when we had a lot of flooding in the Pretoria area, for example. That was caused not by tropical cyclone, but by a tropical system that was situated over the Botswana area and just caused a lot of rain in this particular part of the world. Then also, particularly South Africa and Lesotho experienced flooding from frontal systems in the winter and as what we call cut-off low systems, huge weather systems that come from the western areas over here, and that caused flooding over the southern and eastern parts of the subcontinent, particularly in the winter also. So, if we look at a breakdown of natural disasters first type in SADC from around about 1901 to 2007, according to this database, we can see this top line over here, this blue box of this pie chart is the occurrence of floods. In that period, about 160 floods occurred in SADC compared, and it's the second most compared to epidemics. Epidemics were just more than that. These includes epidemics like measles and diarrhea and that kind of thing, and many of those epidemics are in any case flood-induced. So flood is a huge issue in terms of the number of natural disasters compared to the others. Droughts is there, and windstorms, which include the wind damage from tropical cyclones as well as the kind of damage that is experienced in Capetown area also, is also a huge problem. If we look at the... so therefore, floods in SADC basically comes second to epidemics. It comes third to drought and windstorm in terms of damage that's been caused. Windstorms are mostly the tropical cyclones and frontal systems. And what's important is that from tropical cyclones, Helene and Gloria of Mozambique had 7 billion rand of flood damage caused by those two tropical cyclones in 2000. That's three times the 1999 export. That shows the kind of impact floods can have on a country. It can completely devastate a particularly developing country, their economy and their people's livelihood. This pie charts just show the impact of flooding or natural disasters on people, on humans. And you can see epidemics is the biggest problem in terms of people killed in SADC. Flooding comes second to that one. And people affected, drought obviously being a long-lasting disaster, that will affect more people. But apart from that, flooding comes second as being the number of people being affected in SADC. So again, flood is a huge problem in terms of natural disasters for SADC. This is just a breakdown for countries. If you look at South Africa, Mozambique and Zambia specifically, And we can see here that South Africa, we experienced about 35% of the floods of in terms of all our natural disasters. This is a huge impact again over here. Mozambique, 34%. Again, the highest number of natural disasters comes from flood. And Zambia, they show the epidemics is a bigger problem over there, and flood about 33% in that particular case. If you look on the impact of floods on flood disasters on South Africa, Mozambique, Zambia, as I mentioned, the frequency, most frequent natural disasters in South Africa, Mozambique, second to epidemics in Zambia. The deaths from natural disasters in Mozambique, 37% of the deaths from natural disasters were due to flooding. South Africa, 62%. And Zambia is a bit unclear from the statistics over there. Affecting people, as people are injured, displaced, and so forth, drought is the biggest problem. But then floods are second in terms in Zambia and also in Mozambique, where Mozambique about 8 million people are affected by floods. They have to move away or injured or whatever. And the problem part of it is that in Mozambique about 30 people live per square kilometers in a flood-prone river basin. So there's a lot of people that stay in areas which is flood-prone. That's why about 8 million people are affected. A third of their population are affected by flooding. In that particular country. If you look at some trends in flood occurrences over the last period, what has happened? We've seen the increase in flood occurrences internationally. What has happened in SADC? Well, in the past year period from 1994 to 1988, 9 flood disasters were recorded. From 1994 to 1998, that 5-year period, 26 flood disasters were recorded. And from 1999 to 2003, 59 flood disasters were reported in SADC. A dramatic increase again on the number of flood disasters reported. That 59 includes 10 that suddenly appeared from Angola. That was the first time that they reported flooding. So if you take that away, of course, they were not in the previous two periods, then 49 is still a huge increase from 26 to 49 in terms of the number of floods that occur in SADC and the increase of the number of floods. There's also a dramatic increase in the number of people affected and died in this period, from 4,000 in 1988 to 13,000 in 1998 to 2003. What is interesting is that although flood disasters has increased in time globally, and the damage of flood disasters also has increased in time globally, the number of deaths has decreased in time globally, because and that's been attributed to improved early warning services internationally, as well as perception of people experiencing these things. In study, it has not the number of deaths has not decreased. It has stabilized. It stayed the same basically. So we are a bit behind in that particular aspect. And particularly elderly women and children are affected in this regard. So this upward trend, why so? It's one of the important reasons is the growth in urban population, people living more into the cities which are flood-prone, like Maputo, for example, but also population growth in flood-prone river basins, which has nutritious grounds, there's a lot of water available, people like to settle there, and that has increased dramatically, and that's why so many more people are nowadays affected globally. By floods. That's a big problem. It's not only a static problem, it's an international problem. So what's the future patterns of floods in SADC? I particularly look at the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, the fourth assessment report that just came out, as well as information from the World Meteorological Organization. And from these reports, it's clear that there's a great deal of uncertainty on the impact of climate change on flooding, particularly in SADC. Other parts of the world is a bit more clear, but in southern parts of Africa is very unclear, and there's a lot of uncertainty. The models don't agree with each other on that one. And it's important to know that flood risk is also controlled by other factors than only the weather. We talk here about changes in economic and social systems, we talk about changes in the hydrological aspects, vegetation, soil moisture in the river basin, we talk about land use changes, deforestation, reduction in wetlands, all those things also affect floods. And if you reduce wetlands, you will have more floods in that particular river basin. So it's not only climate, and that's why it's so difficult to have a one-to-one from climate change, increase in temperature doesn't necessarily mean, or increase in precipitation doesn't necessarily mean increase in flooding, or a decrease in precipitation doesn't necessarily mean a decrease in flooding rates. It could be something different.
And that's what makes it very complicated. So there's a lot of research still being done internationally on this particular problem. But what I saw from them is that the IPCC mentioned particularly that even though, for example, in southern Africa it's expected to be drier and warmer in the future, the precipitation intensity, the amount of rain per day in heavy rain days are expected to increase virtually everywhere in the world. And that's important. So although they expect us to be drier, particularly in the central and western parts of the subcontinent, the precipitation intensities are going to increase. We will have more heavy rain events. And basically what they mentioned there, I got a couple of quotes in there. The first one says that a warmer climate with increased variability will increase the risk of both floods and droughts. And they also state there that increasing precipitation intensity and frequency will lead to increasing risk of flooding and droughts in many areas.
Can you explain to us precipitation intensity?
Rainfall intensity, in other words, do we receive 50 millimeters of rain per day or 100 millimeters of rain per day? And they predict here that we will have more rain per day in a heavy rain event than in the past. Even though, if you look at the total annual figure, it might be lower, we will receive less rain in total, but the heavy rain events will be more, basically. And that's what they basically try to state over here. So flood magnitudes and frequencies are likely to increase in most regions. I think from this, what you should say that even though the expectations are that we might be drier and warmer in the future, we should rather be safe and careful with flooding and expect the rise of flooding events to continue as up to now. And therefore, we have to prepare for that kind of eventuality. It's better to be safe and sorry in this particular case. Let us turn to flood forecasting in SADC. We have to distinguish between two kinds of floods for this particular purpose. One we call large-scale river floods, and I'll explain that soon, and then the other one we call flash floods. Now, large-scale river floods, they usually occur in large river basins, and they are from large-scale heavy rain events. Typically, we talk here about the river basin from the Orange River, for example, or the Vaal River basin, or the kind of flood that we experience in the Vaal River, or the Limpopo River, the flooding that we experience with Elene that happened in the Limpopo River or the Zambezi River. The response time between when the heavy rain fall and then the flooding eventually reach a particular location could be, in definition, is more than 6 hours, but it could be up to many days. For example, I've been told by the water face people that heavy rain that falls in Pretoria takes 21 days to reach Whitehead. So we're talking about that kind of scale of flooding. It takes a long time for the flood eventually to reach Mozambique. And to be able to handle this kind of floods, what the hydrologists do, they have complex hydrological models that calculate the river level. They take all the rain that has fallen, calculate how much of that rainwater will eventually end up in the river, what will be the river level now be, and then how will that peak of the river level move down the river. They have all sorts of models that predict that kind of thing, and then they can predict at what time, where will the flooding event be. That is a complex hydrological problem that's been handled in South Africa mainly by the Department of Water Affairs, the flood forecasting room. But we are closely involved with them. We give them all the necessary rainfall information, and we are liaising very closely with them in these situations. What is the situation of flood forecasting in SADC? Unfortunately, not that well. Outside South Africa, there is generally a lack of river forecast systems, these kinds of systems, due to the data problem. There's limited rainfall data being measured, and there's very limited river monitoring data, because the hydrologists need to know what is the level of the river at a certain place so that they can use that to make the predictions for the future. And there's very little of these kinds of data, and that really causes a lot of problems in terms of this. That's why there are few of these flood forecasting systems outside South Africa. In South Africa, we are currently implementing a river forecasting system in the Vaal River. It's almost finished now. It's such a huge effort. It took them about 4 or 5 years just to get this implementation done. It's a huge thing to do. So there's a lot of work to be done to calibrate the river basin into this flood model. The United States has developed following the 2000 floods in Mozambique, they've developed a crude satellite-based system for the Limpopo Basin. And the idea of the satellite-based system is it doesn't use ground-based data, it uses only satellite data to do this flooding. But it's a bit crude because it doesn't use real data, and consequently its accuracy are not that good, but at least it's something. And it's being used to some extent in the Limpopo Basin currently. And there's also some efforts in the Zambezi River, upstream of the Kariba Dam, upstream of the Kabora Wasa Dam, there's some flood modeling there. But again, they are all hampered by the lack of data, which is a big issue there. And I could just make a point here to the Limpopo River Basin, to this map. I don't think this map is in the slideshow over there because it was a bit too big in terms of size. But this is the Limpopo River Basin. You can this black line over here shows the edges of the river basin, and these blue lines are the rivers and the subsidiaries that flows into the Limpopo River Basin. This is the border of South Africa, and you can see four countries are involved over here: South Africa, Botswana, Zimbabwe, and then also Mozambique. In this particular case, South Africa has got a reasonably well data monitoring system over here in terms of rainfall and river gauges. But there's a big problem in the other countries. Consequently, if you don't know what water is coming from those parts, how can you accurately predict what's going to happen in this river? You cannot tap on your the picture. That's the big problem currently. And that's why there's the so-called Limpopo Basin Commission, and one of his tasks is to try and find a way forward in terms of improving on flood forecasting in this basin, including trying to look at the data problem. But there's still a lot of work to be done in this particular case. Then we turn to the other kinds of floods, which is flash floods. They occur in small river basins, very small. We talk about 50 to 200 square kilometers, let's say a 10 by 10 kilometer area. Compare now that to the Limpopo River Basin. These are two different kinds of events. Consequently, the response time between when the heavy rain falls and when the flooding occurs is very, very short. It's less than 6 hours, sometimes 1 to 3 hours. This is a real problem. This is probably one of the big problems internationally also. Traditional hydrological models that are referred to that has been used in the Vaal River, excuse me. Lanesburg.
The Lanesburg flooding that took place in 1998, a typical example of flash flooding.
Lanesburg is a typical example of flash flooding. What happened last year in the George area, Polisburg area, that's typical flash flooding. That's the kind of very short response on the wind flooding occurs. And the normal additional models that they use, for example, in the Vaal River, and they claim that they hope to use in the Limpopo River, doesn't work over here because they take too long to run. You have to have a quick response saying what's going to happen. So the whole process of flash flood forecasting is completely different. And the Weather Services International are far more involved in that kind of situation also. You need to have rainfall measurements on an hourly basis. You need to have rain gauges that can report to you basically in real time. You need to have weather radars that can give you indications of where are the rain falling and what's the intensity of the rain from the radars, etc. and so forth. There's currently, internationally it's a big problem, and even a few developed countries have got a flash flood system. There's been a promising system implemented in Central America in 2004 that's been based on the same system that's been used in the United States, and they've developed a system for Central America. It's really quite a promising piece of work. And that kind of system is what we will eventually allow to use internationally. What's the situation in SADC? There's currently no flash flood warning system operational in SADC, not even in South Africa. South Africa, what we do currently, it's because we don't have that kind of technology yet. We will say there's a heavy rain being predicted in this part of the world with the potential flooding, but we cannot say which river basin, which small river basin will receive the flooding because we just don't have the hydrological information on the ground at this stage. That's a big problem. And it's definitely not elsewhere in SADC being done. Real-time rainfall measurements are only really being done in South Africa, where we've got an hourly report, or even shorter than hourly report from rain gauges. Other countries doesn't do this kind of thing yet. Because we do that, we use SMSs, we use cell phone technology to do that. And in the rural areas, we don't have that technology, we've got a problem.
There are very few weather radars outside South Africa. We've got 9. Mozambique has recently implemented 2 radars. Botswana has got 1, and that's basically it. Zimbabwe has got 4, but they are not really working. And that's it. And the coverage of those in Mozambique and Botswana is really not sufficient for flash flood warnings either. So it's a problem. Data is a problem there. Now, South Africa is currently investigating the implementation of the Central American system in South Africa under the areas, the floodplain regions, which has got radar coverage, and that will probably be a Cape Town, Port Elizabeth, Durban, and Gauteng areas where we will do that kind of. We will implement the system. It will take us about a year and a half to get the system up and running, and then we should have something better. Now, typically, what is the Central American flash flood warning system? This is just one just important product, the output of it. Basically, what it will tell us, in very small river basins, where it's red, it will tell us that area is now a very high likelihood, the probability of flooding already occurring or very close to occurring. In the yellow areas, this possible flooding that could happen in the green areas is safe. So wherever your heavy rain event is, if it's spread over a large part of it, this system eventually will narrow down to which are the real bases that are in danger. And you can then consequently send out warnings to disaster management and tell them which bases you're talking about, and they could then basically focus on those bases and try and do some relief operations, whatever, in that particular basin. That's the whole purpose of, and the whole way of this thing will work. It will be, help us to focus our early warnings in terms of flooding much more than what we are currently able to do. What's the way forward? Basically, what I've found from the literature also, what's been happening, what I know has been happening internationally also, there are 3 major areas that one should concentrate on, and that could be concentrated on. The first one is basically the disaster management approach. Munich reinsurance companies stated that it is not possible to prevent disasters. We rather need to learn to live with them. And I think that's a very important aspect. We cannot stop the disaster. It's going to happen. But we need to learn to live with it. And that's where comprehensive disaster management approaches come in. So the WMO, the World Meteorological Organization, has developed what they call an integrated flood management program as part of a holistic disaster risk management approach. And in here, they look at all aspects. For example, early warning systems, as I mentioned there. They look at socioeconomic activities to balance the needs and the risks. The idea is to look at structural solutions, such as the building of levees and dams and things like that, where it's appropriate. And then also non-structural measures such as land use regulation and those kinds of things. And then very importantly, awareness raising of population and of governments also, of the emergency authorities and those people. This approach should be very strongly supported, because that is ultimately the only way that we are really going to be able to reduce the number of deaths and the impacts of floods. They are going to increase the events, but we have to reduce the impacts. And this is by doing these kinds of things, by falling into this kind of program, this can happen. And SADC is trying to do something like that in the Limpopo River Basin. This LIMCOM, the Limpopo Basin Commission, one of its activities is try to look at such an integrated flood management approach in the area. And there's been some very interesting activities already being done by the different countries that's been presented by them in terms of awareness raising, in terms of regulations and stuff like that. And one of the aspects being touched there is in the early warning system, the flood forecasting technology that I also referred to earlier. So this comprehensive approach is really the one that one will have to embrace and look at. So actually it means that what we can do about flooding is not one organization's own. It's something that the entire country, all departments, everybody will have to embrace and work towards. The second one is early warning through flood forecasting. The WMO emphasized that in this integrated flood management approach, the most critical aspect of flood loss reduction lies in emergency preparedness and response, and particularly in a flood forecasting warning system. So in their eyes, a flood forecasting warning system is critically important. It's one of the most important aspects. And therefore, we should do what we can to improve the situation. This requires collaboration between meteorologists, hydrologists, disaster managers, and it requires collaboration between countries also, particularly where river bases are shared.
once again, if we turn to the two different kinds of floods and see what's the situation for each one of them in terms of the large-scale river floods, first of all, what's important is to develop comprehensive hydrological river forecasting models for the large basins, those ones that we would ideally like to have in the Limpopo, in the Zambezi, and efforts should be stepped up to do that kind of thing. This is a long-term solution, basically because it depends heavily on the improvement of rainfall measurement, the data issue. It depends on rainfall measurement, it depends on river level monitoring of all the riparian countries in the river basins, and so forth. And again, as I mentioned, the Limpopo Basin Commission is doing some work in this regard already. But we should do it, because eventually we will get there. I believe that we should also try and look at some more crude interim measures to have at least some guidance on the ground. And one of those could be this United States satellite-based system that's currently being used in the Limpopo Basin. It's easier to implement the system because you don't need surface data. You don't need those rainfall measurements. It's all done by satellite. But that's also part of the problem. Because it's done by satellite, it's accurate. And also, it does not really use real data. So consequently, there's some reservations by some people in terms of using this. But I believe that to have at least something is better than to have nothing. So it could give some sort of guidance if this kind of system is being looked at and evaluated also for other river basins. And then for flash floods, first of all, as I mentioned, South Africa is currently investigating the implementation of that Central American flash flood warning system. The value of it can operate on a radar coverage in flash flood basins of very small size, 50 to 100 square kilometers approximately. And this will really complement the weather service current early warning system that Manikela already referred to. But I think the other one that's important that's coming also, the World Meteorological Organization is planning the development of a global flash flood warning system called the FFGS. And the important thing is this is also based on the same Central American system, using only satellite information. Now, the important thing is this can be rolled out where no surface data exists. So it can be rolled out over static, for example, and that's what they plan also. It can, unfortunately, because it's only using satellite data, it only works for larger river bases, about 200 square kilometers, whereas the weather radar-based one will be for smaller river bases. But 200 square kilometers are still good enough in size and could be pretty useful to have this kind of system. The plan is to implement this system on a regional basis, like SADC, by about 2010. And then in 2010, Southern Africa SADC will become one of the test areas for this planned system. And again, we can then use the same way to do it as we are doing it currently with the Severe Weather Demonstration Project also. Excuse me. So consequently, the Weather Service will, as an RSM scheme, regional specialized med center will play and can and will play a pivotal role in this particular activity. And I think that will at least give SADC some kind of angle on flood forecasting, at least on the flash flood time scale, but it will eventually help also for the largest scale floods. And then thirdly, very importantly, we have to get more data. That is something that SADC has to do. Reliable weather and hydrological data is essential for flood forecasting systems, particularly rainfall, river flow, and water level monitoring. The WMO again is operating what they call SADC HYCOS. It's a hydrological observing system, hydrological cycle observing system program, and it's aiming at improving the hydrological monitoring, in other words, this river level flows and the water levels and so forth. And that's what I think about 43 stations already implemented in SADC in the first phase, and then the second phase, as far as I understand, is going to end by next year. But we need to get this kind of activities more and more of them. Importantly is that National Weather Service, National Met Services, must continuously improve their existing rainfall networks, and they must do that substantially. We need more, quite a lot of rainfall stations, at least. If they cannot implement a proper automatic weather station that's pretty expensive, at least rain gauges is very important. Problem again, this depends heavily on funding levels, and that is why many of the study countries are struggling with this kind of situation. But I think efforts should be stepped up to try and
do what we can to try and improve from this perspective. I think broadly that is the kind of message that I was having in my presentation over here. What I would like to do is just to end up with something that summarizes the whole approach of integrated disaster risk management. And this is a poem that was that came from a grade 6 pupil in White Beach. She said, "For there is no Noah among us. Let us do it ourselves. Let us not attempt to cross flooded rivers. Let us not build our homes on river banks. Let us not build our homes on lowland. Let us fill gullies and stop them from becoming rivers. For there is no Noah amongst us. Let us protect ourselves from floods." And I think that summarizes from this viewpoint. This comes from the Limpopo Basin Commission activities, one of the awareness raising activities. And what she's trying to summarize there in a way is basically that this is a holistic approach. We have to wear this raising among people, building up the resilience of people to be able to cope with flooding, improving warnings. That's what we have to do if we want to overcome this huge disaster problem. I thank you, President.
Dr. Pullman, I think at this stage we can invite members to ask questions from the separate two presentations. Honorable Morgan, Kosmeni, Manduli, Machamas, in that order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the presenters for the effort they put into the research that went into those presentations. I really just wanted you to expand on the comments on we need to live with floods and understand that they're kind of inevitable. With regards particularly to flash floods, I mean, I understand what the sentiment behind that particular statement is. And I know that you would probably agree with this, and of course our aim should also be to ameliorate the effects of floods and to lessen the impact. But I'm thinking here particularly about the way we accentuate flooding through our human actions and then that relationship with the we need to live with floods. Because if you think of, and you said it in your presentation before, the effects of deforestation, agriculture, increased agriculture and so on, and then if you link to that poor urban planning, concretization of our towns and cities, poor litter collection that damages watercourses and so on. I mean, those are all, I mean, granted there might be a number of micro issues, but you did say that it requires a holistic response. And those goes to the broader cross-cutting issues of the work that this portfolio does concern itself with. Everything from waste management to deforestation, all of which have an effect on the extent of flooding, although we can't influence, you know, the actual rainfall, as you say. So that was just really a comment on that. And then just a more broadly political sort of comment on your impressions on, and you say that obviously South Africa has the most capacity, and I understand that, but are our fellow countries in SADC regarding this as high a priority as they should be, considering that flooding is, in the case of Mozambique and South Africa and almost in Zambia, the most frequent form of natural disaster? And the reason I ask that is because as in any developing country, and sometimes it happens in this country as well, there are a number of competing issues that need to be dealt with, from poverty to AIDS and so on, and that sometimes the environment isn't necessarily put at the top of the agenda. So an impression on how seriously they're dealing with it. I understand that we're working with them, so that's very good. And then, of course, whether there is increased funding from world bodies in order to increase the capacity, particularly in those countries.
Thank you, Chair. I just want also to latch on the issue of town planning, peri-urban planning, which sometimes contribute to flooding, flash flooding in particular. I don't know whether you do have an opportunity to raise some of these issues together with your sister departments if there is such a forum, so that when they go about putting infrastructure for peri-urban development, you know, they would actually avoid, you know, structures or roads that would actually enhance flooding. Like in some townships, you find that they construct paved roads, which actually collect water all over when there's heavy rain. In one township, I know, last year they reported 3 deaths as a result of that. The other question is around the warnings by weather services, and even by those that are actually warning about the flooding. Have we considered making use of the corporates like MTN and Vodacom, so that if there are flood warnings, so that the word should spread across people that do not have radios, that might have not read newspapers or watch TV, they could also access this information through SMSs that could be issued, you know, distributed by these big corporates. Because these days, almost every person, not everyone, but the majority of people do have cell phones. And sometimes in other rural areas, you even have these networks from MTN and Vodacom, including Cell C. So have we considered, Cell C doesn't have, I don't know, right. Have you considered perhaps inviting them to the party?
Members were still 3 years from the election, so please don't over elaborate. Machaman?
Thank you, Chair. Mr. President, thank you very much for the information that has been presented to us. And really, these are the things that we experience as human beings. I wanted to share something to say in the issue of the caterers. Now, it's easy in the urban area, township, etc. And also the issue of SSSs. Now, I am from a rural area whereby you come with your own Nokia cell phone or MTN cell phone, but it's not going to work because there is no network. Now, I'm looking at such situation to say that is true. Everybody is a victim here. All areas are victims, but rural areas are more vulnerable. Now, you see in the rural areas, it's the privilege to be along the banks of the river because you are going to have fields, etc., etc. But isn't it the time that as the department we come up with something like protected areas, but we don't have people residing in such areas? And to the first presenter talked about other countries having no resources through financial constraints. I wanted to check on that one to say, if really the country in such conditions can't have financial resources, what does it mean to be a SADC member? What does that mean? What UN can do on such situations? We agree that yes, we are going to leave with floods. When I was looking at one of the demonstrations here, I saw 1978. I really experienced that one. But in some areas, I think our government now, because with the look of things, the most people that were affected were the people that were residing on the city area, etc., etc. To say, what is it that we can come up with? We can't avoid, we can't stop floods. Floods is coming. But sort of to put people on the safer place. And I wanted to check again if you guys are aware of the areas that are experiencing this disaster more regularly. And if that is so, is there any mechanism that can divide to also protect the people? Because for me, in Mozambique, the first night you had a baby that was born on the tree. The second one, you have a baby that was born on the tree. That means, seemingly, those people are in one and the same area. But some of the things here, some of the things are really valid information. We can't do otherwise, but now I'm aging. I'm pleading to you guys, as you have recommended, as the birth here in South Africa, to go back with these IT things, etc., etc., and try and devise some means. Because, you know, you go to Japan, you are told that they are now houses that are earthquake registered. Even if the magnitude is not that bad, they know the level. There will be an earthquake, but those houses will not affect it. I mean, to come closer to such situations. Thank you.
That was Mandu Machama.
Thank you, Chair. Just on the forecasting, I was wondering at the time when you said that you know, there was this 5 days lead time by the South African Weather Service. I mean, that's amazing. And I just wondered whether the question I was going to ask is how absolutely predictable are cyclones? I mean, when they are swirling around there and coming, are they? And you said that Reunion had given a different forecast, which had that been the, maybe because they don't have the technology as upmarket as up to date as ours, what would have been the result if their forecast had been followed instead of the South African one, which was really ahead of the game? That was interesting, but I also wondered how are the other SADC countries going to catch up as far as their, not only their equipment and their technology, but their personnel. I mean, it's really great to hear that we are training 13 Tanzanian people to our technology. But does the WMO get involved in assisting under-resourced countries to try to catch up with their equipment and training? Because it not only affects the country involved, but it affects the entire region. And then around the flooding, I mean, I come from Port Elizabeth. I was involved in that 1968 flood when there was, I think, something like 27 inches in 24 hours and 17 inches in about 5 hours, and just wiped the whole center of the city out. It was amazing. But something that, and it follows on what others have said around the continued devastation to people living in flooding and known flooding areas. I mean, in PE on the Scott Cook's train, there's a whole of little, what they call little Soweto. The shops go back again every time. So what is your... concerned, are you able to put the case urgently to them and work with them around known flooding areas and what will certainly be in the future another flood in that same area? So just wonder whether you do, or do you leave it to the local DEITCH officials, or can you work directly with municipalities? Is there a proactive way to assist them as far as floodplain planning is concerned? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to find out. What bothers me most is we can come up with all these wonderful plans, legislations, whatever, and so forth. But if we are not strong enough to make sure that we implement those rules and regulations, they're not worth the piece of paper that it's written on. The reason why I'm saying that is most townships, when they are established, you've got town planners who would look at the area and identify certain floodplain areas, come up with rules and regulations and say that you may not build from this area onward because it is a flood-prone area. But what we see happening in our cities, we ignore all those. We've got local authorities, we've got health inspectors, we've got all these institutions set, and they come up with these rules and regulations and ignore them. Now, at the end of the day, you ask yourself a question. Who is actually responsible? Is it the people themselves? Or perhaps it is the authorities that have identified these dangerous areas and have set up rules and regulations and failed to act on them? What do we do in a position like that? Now, the second question is, it's weather forecast challenges in the region. We have realized or identified the fact that certain countries lack resources. My question is, what other alternative means of communication can we sort of use as an alternative since we don't have the resources? And I don't believe that weather patterns or weather disasters are something new. They've been happening ever since immemorial. But people, I would like to think, had ways of trying to make sure that they sort of
minimize disasters as far as that is concerned. So, I mean, it might not sound like very important questions, but when one uses his common sense and look at what's happening, I see as if we are our worst enemies, because we are aware of what the problems are, but we don't take the initiative to make sure that we circumvent these kind of problems. Thank you.
I discovered that there is a lot of science and technology involved. But well, you know, at times you need to try and collect some knowledge just for an ordinary layman, you know. Coming to any warning systems, how is it applied in case of flying? Each time I'm in that flight, I always think of Pretoria. What? That wonderful place where Ndabambi does his things. Where we've been. What? No. What? Water services. But it's in Centurion. Okay? How is it applied in case of flight? These warnings. Yeah. Yes. Well, I remember what happened in Kenya, and you can name them. And then, secondly, I say, when I meet just an ordinary layman, what effect do mountains and forests have towards rainfall, which eventually, as far as I'm concerned, cause flooding? What effect do those two have? We were discussing fires and floods, which comes often between the two, fires and floods. I was very much excited when I learned that South Africa seemed to be leading, you know. But I just want to know, maybe they can just expand a little bit from that. How did you manage to be the leading group when it comes to application of weather focused information? Thank you.
Ngozi Maskara, just a question from my side. Do you want to hear something from Gwen? Okay. The first one is, can this water from flooding, can it be captured? Can you trap it, use it to make dams, etc.? What are the prospects of that in Southern Africa? Secondly, what would be the cost implications of a real-time monitoring system in the Southern African region? What would be the cost implication of installing such a system? And thirdly, we are visiting some of these countries, Botswana, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique. What should we raise with them? Give us a mandate. What should we raise when we meet as MPs in the region? What are the key issues that you think would want to mandate us to do when we meet them? Thank you. the last one, and the rest is one round, and you respond to it. If you've got more time later, after the other presentation, you can still come. So, Gatambuena and Manzan after that.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll associate myself firstly with the comment made by Honorable Mr. Morgan here to congratulate the panel for a very well prepared and well researched presentation. They're just not speaking from the shaking their thumbs. Dealing with a very, very complicated but fascinating aspect of our lives, you know, the behavior of the weather. It's something that's really fascinating. but I wanted to come up with just a few suggestions, and not being an expert, of course, but being a lawmaker here, placed in this sphere of government and legislation. Number one, it's actually a question before this lesson. When we visited the offices of the South African Weather Services in June, as a patrol committee, we were fascinated by, among others, the factory that you have put together to manufacture gadgets that forecast weather. And I was actually amazed by the retail price, which is about 200,000 a piece. But you said that, you know, you had the lack of marketing. In other words, you know, there wasn't a proper marketing strategy to ensure that countries that would need it would actually just buy it. So I want to find out if there's any improvement in source strategy of marketing this very, very available gadget that will assist SADC in the manner of predicting the weather, like you already have that confession. Number two, I don't appear very pessimistic about dealing with these disasters. Because I've got a view that, because we as human beings, I mean, the whole question of flooding is caused, is an act of God, but it's also caused by human negligence. Now, we can intervene as humans by building tunnels in order to channel, especially as the service has indicated. You'll be visiting some of the other countries. Well, with this huge water reserve of the Zambezi River, whose provenance is the Great Lakes. It comes from the Great Lakes. It travels 2,700 kilometers from the Great Lakes into Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, where it actually floods and before it enters the sea. And that Mozambique is geomorphologically formed as a basin. So it will always be a catchment area for the big Zambezi River. Now, if we, from our side, can redirect that water, come to the Limpopo, through a very, very big tunnel, like the canal, like the 7 million Lesotho Highlands Water Project. So that's where our human intervention is coming. It's going to be a highly capital intensive project, but I think we must do it. You know, when the Lesotho project was mooted, it appeared like a pipe dream and a waste of money, but now we are all benefiting. I'm told that if it fails to rain in Johannesburg for 3 years, there's not a snow drop. The Kato Dam can supply Johannesburg for 3 years. Now, if we can start now, President, as parliamentarians, Chairperson, and Ulysses, as we visit the Amazon district, and especially in the country, in the government collaboration, of getting overseas investors to construct a very huge canal that can capture this water. So the water doesn't actually go and drown the people of Mozambique, because it's excess water. So that's where the human intervention can actually come in. The other point, Chairperson, the last 2 points, is, it sounds like a contradiction, an oxymoron. A strategy of hindsight proactive reconstruction. In other words, where the flood has been struck, you know, just like in Lisbon, where the Buffalo River it came up in flood. And apart from the excellent rescue operation that is being mounted to the collaboration on health and defense forces, etc., etc., to rescue people to minimize damage. When the flood is gone, we don't know when it's going to come back. But I think there should be hindsight, as you see, it's a mistake size. We should prepare that in the event of another one coming, we shouldn't catch us with our pants down. And that leads me to the last point. The last point is that of public works. We should rope in public works, because they want a lot of money. Now we hear the government has got 400 billion, 400,000 billion, no money, 400 billion, sorry, 400 billion, because it's a good chance, 400 billion to roll out in terms of infrastructure building, instead of putting all this money into all sort of interesting but peripheral public works, because of a lot of money, what else can we do with it? We should actually channel most of that money into proactive disaster management in terms of infrastructure capacity building. Thank you, Chairman.
Chair, thank you very much. I would like to thank the presenters for their presentations. I've only got one question, Chair. That is, during this forecasting of about this severe weather and like maybe the actions in Mozambique, like the cyclones, the floods, the cyclones where people suffer. Now, what happens to our marine resources? Do they die, or is there a way to have them safe from all the actions of what the weather, you know, the weather and because it won't, it doesn't need the seas. They when disasters come, they don't need the seas. But now, what I would like to know is, what happened? Do they remain the same, or do we? Do we get, part of it defeated? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, ma'am. I hope you can recruit the questions so that you don't answer each of them one by one. So some of the thematic questions, hopefully you can capture that.
Yes, thank you, Chair. What I will do, I'll group them into two. Those that deals with flooding, I'll ask Eugene to deal with them. And those that deals with forecasting and more on the dissemination of information to rural, to people in the rurals, and I'll ask Michele to deal with that. I'll quickly touch on the one that talks to the sort of resources that we have and what sort of actions we're taking as South African Weather Service, knowing that we do have, you know, challenges in this part of the world. There is a body called Meteorological Association of South Africa. It's called MASA. We as SADC directorate or SADC directors have come together, formed this association, still in its development stage. We've recently finalized the constitution thereof, which has to go through the SADC organs. That body precisely is going to help us in raising funds. Because you'll know that it's difficult these days just as one country to go and even get funding from whether World Bank or any donor. They would like to fund a project that is a regional, like regional project. So we have realized the challenges that we have more on the infrastructure, I mean the instruments that are being used, the communication, and looking after and maintaining those instruments that we have, and also the training part. So we thought that if we have this body, we can use that in pushing and getting and leveraging and getting funding. Again, with this body, what one could still do, because I mean, you could look into if we purchase things like upper air soundings, which are very expensive, we could do we could buy in bulk and agree to all the federal countries, and we can really negotiate based on that. And that will help us in improving our measurements in this part of the world. And talking to the issues around the mandate, for me, the mandate should talk to issues around the infrastructure. I've alluded that, you know, we can be the best in South Africa and have our own instruments. But if our neighbors don't have that, we're worse off. I mean, if you look at USA, it might not be in good terms with their neighboring countries, Cuba or what. But then when coming to a metrological measurements and what, they really work together. So that their country could be well, you know, informed or well warned ahead of time. So for me, infrastructure is such an important element. Yes, we do have technical services where we manufacture some of these instruments. Precisely, if we get this matter to run, we can then use the funding from donors and what to put this manufacturing instrument, and then we can put in those instruments in the select countries. So for me, infrastructure is the most important thing. To help us not only in focusing, it also help us in flooding, as you've seen in this presentation, that yes, we're lacking measurements, and then we can't warn our people ahead of time. So that to me would be the first one. I'll just pass over to my colleagues while I'm thinking about others and come back to this one. Miguel, maybe let me just start with you to deal with questions relating to dissemination of information.
Thank you, Dr. Mtazi. Some of the questions are interrelated. It's difficult to say which is which. I think my colleague Eugene will also listen as I speak, so that we don't repeat the same thing. I just would like to comment on the one whether SADC regards flooding as high priority. It's just a comment because I don't know really within the SADC structure how it is based on priority. And again, trying to recall that what the chair has said, that we should also perhaps share some recommendations. The example of the tropical cyclone Fido, the recent one this year in February, where South Africa was proactive. What we wanted there, we wanted Mozambique to ask for help, so that the helicopters can be able to fly in. Because once the tropical cyclone arrives, they cannot fly in and out. So that we can, perhaps, the defense force can take people from those low-lying areas to somewhere. So that was the kind of help we were thinking of when we asked the Department of Foreign Affairs to conduct Mozambique. But the response that we received there was that, those people are stubborn. They gave up on them. They keep going back and build there. They don't want to leave those places. And, if the meeting we had was on the 20th, the tropical cyclone was coming on the 22nd. So we had at least 2 to 2.5 days. But there was no request from Mozambique that, okay, proactively people should be rescued. So maybe those are the one of the things that you can emphasize. You can make an example like that where we see that people's lives are threatened. You know, let's work with each other, more especially if another country has got the potential and is showing an interest to go and help. I hope Eugene will touch the one on the urban planning. I don't really have much skills on it. But in terms of collaborating with sister departments, the collaboration now is being enhanced, and I think the National Disaster Management Office in Pretoria is playing a leading role to try to make sure that the departments are working with each other. What they are trying to do now, which was not happening before, is to sort of make sure that this is happening at provincial level and also at municipality level. Because it has been strong at national level and provincial level. But the people that are close to the people are local municipalities. So the Disaster Management Department or the Department of Local Government now is enhancing that. Recently we met other municipality people in Mpumalanga. So I think it's a matter of it's starting, we should see some improvement. The question of the warning, whether we consider making use of MTN, Vodacom, etc., maybe to also use the SMS. That is on the discussion.
Mm.
The challenge now is that we also don't want to cause unnecessary panics. We received some few examples where the people, when they get the warnings, they evacuate people unnecessarily, and that can be costly. Our approach now, more especially in terms of linking to the severe weather warning, early warning SMS system, is to promote awareness, capacitate those people. We've got now a scheduled meeting from Mpumalanga, for example, before we can link the disaster management organizers from the municipality level. We want to workshop them. So the workshop that we are doing with media, we are aggressive this financial year. So we are hoping that at least within the next 2 years, we should be in the better position now where we would say people are aware, we will do the surveys and look how people are aware. We don't want these things to work against us. We would like them to work for us. So it is there, but we don't want to just impose them like that. We want to prepare people so that they are ready to receive them. There are some discussions around that. Looking at the question of vegetation is easy in urban areas and townships. In rural areas, sometimes the network is not there, so even though your SMS won't work. We are looking at the alternatives. We are trying to engage local people and the institutions. So we've got a project here in Cape Town. This project is actually a flag project, whereby it will be a blue flag if people shouldn't be careful, maybe in the informal settlement they want to make fires, and then a red if they should not. So we've got projects like that, which we think they will be more appropriate to all the areas, more especially for the rural areas. Then if it succeeds, local people are involved, it succeeds, then it's going to be implemented. The question of forecasting 5 day lead time. How predictable are the tropical cyclones? Why was South African forecast not followed? That is very difficult to predict tropical cyclones. That's why sometimes the prediction of the direction can be changed within 3 hours. It's not easy. It's not a matter of the South African forecast was not followed. Okay. So the La Reunion, they are an official center that issues the tropical cyclone warnings in terms of tracks, where is it going to land. So in this part, we are predicting the heavy rain. I can say it's also about an experience in terms of understanding these forecasting tools and which one you believe. Because in this case, the other numerical weather prediction models that were followed by La Reunion were pointing it to go south. But the other one, which was including what we call this MWF model, was showing it to go to Mozambique. So in South African weather service, when we predict, we look at the tropical cyclones, we tend to believe that one, looking at the past experience. So it's the data analysis, when you about to come up with a focus is quite complex. So sometimes you cannot say no, they don't have skills. It could have happened that what we followed was wrong, and then if it does not come, it moves south. Thank you. Okay, there was something about municipalities, I think I did touch on that. The weather forecast challenges in the region, what are the other means and the way of communication can we use within the region? What are the alternatives that we can use to minimize disasters? Because we are aware of the problems, but we don't take initiatives. It's very, very difficult. Within South Africa, we're trying other alternatives, for example, as to how to reach to the rural areas. So within the region, I think this severe weather forecasting demonstration project is the first one that is also bringing us together. We are hoping to come up with the alternatives because the guidelines of the project are that there should be interaction between South Africa, South African Weather Forecasting Office, and the Weather Forecasting Office of that country. But it should go beyond that. There should also be a feedback from civil protection authorities of various countries. I hope this is the first step that can also create a forum where collectively we can come with a solution for the region or with some initiatives for the region. I think I don't remember anything significant at the moment. Maybe Eugene will have something here. On the question of how do we want for flying for aviation, the example of Kenya was also mentioned. For aviation, we give recommendations. The pilot makes a final decision. Sometimes we'll have a long argument. I can give you an example of a visual flying pilot. You will tell the pilot that the cloud level is closer to the mountain. I don't recommend that you fly. And then the pilot will say, I know the area. I'll fly around those mountains. And then we've seen a lot of those small aircraft crashing on the mountain. So it's the same with the other pilots. We only recommend, so the pilot must take a decision. I must say my view, which is my view, is that with time, the pilots are so getting used to flying. You know, it's like now, like gentleman driving. You can see some how fast they are landing. So at the end of the day, it's their decision whether they fly or not. And the other question is, what are the effects of the forest and mountains have on the rain? That was a very a technical question. At one stage, I thought the honorable member has got an insight in forecasting techniques because they play quite a significant role. Things like tornadoes, the mountain, they play a role to trigger that as well. And then the forest, the evaporation also that is taking place, that is also helping to enhance for the available moisture in the atmosphere. Sometimes the mountain can help to trigger the upward movement of air. And it's what you need for rain. You need upward movement, cooling condensation clouds, and then you get rain. So they play quite an important role. That's why in the start I could give a guidance, and then we say the forecasters who know the topography must downscale it because they know the local topography. I don't know which hotels often fires and floods officially. I don't remember we're doing the research on that. But just to my memory, I think the floods, they occur more often than fires, but that is subjective. How did South Africa manage to become a leading group? I think what has helped South Africa is the investment in the technology. We've got supercomputers, we've got equipment that our neighboring countries don't have. Because in these kind of things, you need to invest in the technology. And I think we need to thank our mother department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism for that. Because when we motivated, they listened to us. That has helped us a lot.
Michelo, let's just move over to Eugene. If there are any other questions that you might feel that you haven't covered, we'll come back to them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members. Well, I think we've got a number of the questions touch in a way, in terms of flooding, on the same kind of thing. And that comes back to the first of my proposals that we should really support, and that is the whole integrated flood management access, process, activities. This all falls under what we could call the typical disaster risk management activity. That's the way the disaster risk management, risk management nowadays operate. It's a holistic process where you involve predictive preparedness, mitigation factors, relief operations, as well as a reaction afterwards, how do you build up again. And I think flooding falls in exactly that same realm. One has to look at the total spectrum of that, and therefore the weather service actually plays a very small role in that bigger circle. What is important is that the disaster risk management setup internationally and also in South Africa has developed incredibly in the last 10 years, like, I think. And in South Africa, we are really getting in the forefront of this kind of activity, how it should be a holistic approach, which means that you cannot only react and pull people out of flood, and I think that's the end of your activities. You should also have the warnings beforehand, but you should also have mitigation factors. You should try and learn the lessons, as somebody mentioned, and then try to see, well, how can we change things now that it doesn't reoccur in the same area? And that is where disaster risk management activities come in, and that involves a whole host of departments. As Kerry mentioned, there are quite a number of departments involved in the disaster risk management meetings. And there is nowadays a career called disaster risk manager, and this person is there to basically facilitate the process. In South Africa currently, we've got provincial disaster risk management units, and now we've got also municipal disaster risk management units. The Weather Service works very closely with them, giving them the warnings that they need. They are then trained to react on those warnings on the one hand. On the other hand, they are also trained to do the necessary risk assessments in their particular district. They must go out and assess their district and see for floods, for fires, for technological hazards, what are the risks? And they must come up with mitigation activities in their particular district, and then they must work with their departments in the councils, in the provinces, to try and come up with ways and means to overcome that problem. So it's a whole holistic, integrated process. And I think that in South Africa we are getting really there with quite a good system, and that process must be, in my mind, heavily supported. This whole process of disaster risk management and activities. There are, unfortunately, some areas, as far as I understand, I'm not in the disaster management department myself, but there are districts where they still struggle to get a disaster risk manager to do work. So we have to really start pushing that area. If we really want to get this holistic pattern working, then that is the area that we have to push. Make sure that there are disaster risk managers in all districts and that they do the work that they're supposed to do. Without that, the Weather Service can never, never reach the people on the ground as we would like to. It's not possible. It's those people that really eventually, even the warnings that we issue, go through them, and they have to react on those warnings because they know in their district where is the real problems. It's impossible for our forecast to know what's happening in a small district somewhere. So it's an integrative process, it's a collaborative process. And I think that is a very important function of Chicago. And we are part of that total process. We are playing a very active part. We are actually attending their conferences nowadays and give the presentations on the conference on these kinds of topics. Typically, flooding will be, again, a topic that will be coming up in the next conference that's going to occur in October somewhere in the Eastern Cape. So I think that is a holistic answer to some of these questions. In terms of living with floods, what do we mean by that? Basically, exactly that. We cannot run away from the floods to take everybody out. That's not realistic. It's not economically viable. So we need to know how to deal with flooding and when warnings are issued for flooding. People need to learn if we issue a warning, what should they do? The local disaster manager, the local structures need to know what actions they should take to try and reduce the risk and the impact of that particular flooding. So that is where what they mean when they say we need to live with these floods. We need to learn to live with the flood. That's an international way of doing things nowadays also. In terms of the urban development, I think it falls in exactly the same category which I mentioned. In other words, those town planners, they need to get on board of this disaster risk management strategy. I know that one of the activities of disaster risk management is that they are getting involved in this integrated development plans that each district must have. They must play a role in that. The risk manager must approve those plans because he knows what's the flooding and the other kinds of risks and what should not be done and what should be done. Or he's supposed to know. And he's supposed to give the input in there. And that is where this holistic approach again comes in. In terms of the rural areas more vulnerable, that is actually the problem of developing countries. And that makes it more difficult. If you compare, for example, developed countries, they have to issue a warning, they do that in a particular way, and the people hear and they react to it. In developing countries, you have to actually issue two different warnings. One is for the developed part of that country, like cities, and a different kind of warning for the rural part. And that is a very complicated thing. It's interesting to see what different countries do in this regard. For example, Madagascar, they still raise flags to warn of cyclones approaching. Of course, that works for them. In Malawi, they will send somebody on a bicycle to warn communities because that works for them. So that brings us back to indigenous knowledge in terms of coping with disasters. That must be elevated. That must be captured, and that must be built on basically. We cannot try and come up with developed activities, developed ways of doing things in rural areas. You have to come up with what's the best working there and basically capture that and work on that. And I think that's the important thing there. Let me just see here then. In terms of people again living in flooding areas, I think that comes back to exactly the same question and the same activity of disaster risk management, that they should be involved. We cannot get the take the people out because they will go back. As Nikhil said, that's what happened in Mozambique. So in Mozambique, the disaster risk managers knew about the problem, and consequently, the impacts of Harvey was far less than the impacts of Eileen was 4 years ago, or in 2000, actually, 7 years ago. Because the disaster manager in Mozambique has learned the lessons how to cope with this kind of situation. In terms of fires and flooding, flooding do occur more in South Africa. The actual hazard, or the actual event, happens more in South Africa. But we do issue the fire conditions, or conditions that can lead to fires, are actually more often occurred, and then therefore we issue far more warnings on potential for runaway fires. But luckily, the events of fires itself doesn't happen as often as the floods does. Can water from flooding be captivated in dams? I think it's been done in many countries, for example. That's why we've got some dams being built, particularly that purpose. It's a very expensive kind of thing. It's something that needs to be planned and worked on by that particular river basin commission. Zambezi and Mpopo River Basin Commission is looking together, those kinds of things. And that also touched on the question of can we move the water from one basin to another basin. That is actually the area for Department of Water Affairs to talk to. It's hydrological and the hydraulic problem basically. From my personal perspective, what would be the impact on the ecosystem of the river that you move the water away? That's something to be taken into account, I guess. But I'm not an expert in this kind of industry. There was the questions on human action again. I hope I've dealt with that. And the on-cause proactive idea, that's exactly what disaster risk management is all about. And public works should play their role in the total disaster risk management framework. They should be part of that picture in any case. And then finally, the question of what should be raised with countries. Well, personally, I believe the support that these governments should give to exactly this disaster risk, this integrated development approaches, I think that should be emphasized on our side. Because that is the only way that we are really going to deal with the impacts of these disasters and floods itself. And I think another thing that's very important also is that if you think about the data, why do weather services have so few money in these countries? I think, do they really get the political support that they need from their countries? And maybe that should be right. The political support from to the weather services, to the disaster managers, to the hydrological organizations, so that they can have the equipment to do their job and in that way eventually reduce the impact of this one. I hope that I broadly answered these questions that that's been raised. Thanks.
Within a minute or so.
Thank you, Chair. Now, it's not that I could not answer your question. I see the listener is not touching it. The one you wanted to know the cost of implication of real-time flooding monitoring system. I don't know if he knows it.
Chair, this is a difficult one, actually, because we're talking about data platforms itself, like automatic weather stations and communication links from that station to the nearest place. If it's outside SMS reach, you'll have to use satellite means. It becomes really, very complicated and across the coast. It really depends on the area to area what is the best way of doing it. You need power at the station and things like that. So it really depends on the situation. It's an assessment that will have to be done in country by the particular country knowing the situations over there. So from my side, I can't think that I can't easily give an answer to that.
Chairperson, I asked a question on the construction of the canal, along the tube canal. It was as that, but I noticed that you're a little bit resting at the time. It was as that. So, for your indulgence, the answer was that it can, some that can be looked at, but the presenter asked whether what impact will that canal have on the ecosystems. But maybe you can say more now that you are with us. Okay.
Well, thank you for doing that.
Chair, again, I'm a meteorologist, I'm not a hydrologist and a hydraulic engineer, so it's difficult for me to say what will be the impact on that kind of thing. You need the impact assessment of that. Obviously, it can be done. We do that in South Africa in certain bases. We move water from different bases, basins. So I'm quite sure that practically can be done, but my question is just what about the impacts of that? If you move the water away from the Zambezi to the Mpopo and then Mozambique doesn't get all the water they need for their normal activities, what will be the impact there? Can we really divert the flood in that particular way? I'm not sure about that. That's where the hydrological engineers will have to come in.
The Zambezi is just a normally flowing river. It will not use floods. That river travels 2,700 kilometers from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Gongola, then travels to Zambia, Zimbabwe. It's a normal river like the Limpopo. And it's all just like the orange river that comes from the Mount of Sources and goes right up to the and being used for irrigation purposes. The same concept. So it's not a question of floods. The flooding is when it comes to Mozambique, the same from the same river. Because Mozambique is like a basin, so Mount of Sources can be shaped like that. Then it floods Mozambique. But when it comes to the flood, in this bad for the lakes, great spectacle of the Shura Falls. So I'm just saying to harness that water there. And of course, use two states so that now you regulate and you realize that now the Limpopo River is going to flood and then you divert it like that. So you see, the temperature is going to be hitting us there and we don't have to fly kite there. We want to be informed by you to say what you actually think if all other things are equal. And just the chaplain to just smuggle another idea. Dr. Mchepa, the Queen Mozart, the rainmaker. Have you had an opportunity? I know you guys are scientists, but then that's I'm linking into the question of traditional coping capacities of disaster and rain prediction. Have you, when the scientists actually say, "Hello, ma'am," just to deal with this mystic of rainmaking, which causes some fascination?
It's part of indigenous knowledge systems. Okay.
Yes, as weather services, it's one project that we have started last year. And as I'm talking to you, there is a team of scientists that have been assigned to this project that will look at the Queen Mujaji project, that will look at harnessing some of the forecasting, regional forecasting in two or regional offices, and that another one that will look into the lighting issue. So there have been, you know, a lot of documentation around this. We've managed to get hold of someone that has done a lot of literature around indigenous knowledge that we'll be working with, and also University of Vet. So at this stage, I cannot talk more until such time that we really researched that. Yes, we know that our people used to survive in adverse climate. I mean, it's not something that is happening today. We really need to look into that and see how do we adapt, or how they used to adapt and learn from those lessons. Let me quickly just touch on something that was raised around WMO, if it does come to party and assist. Yes, it does. WMO has two programs that I'll say it looks into least developing country, where one of them is a voluntary program where some Met offices that they put into a fund, and that fund is used to really help the least developing country, mainly in Africa. And as South African way of saying this, from time to time we get called to go and assist our neighboring countries, or even maybe other African countries in technical problems. Whenever we're called, we do respond to that. So they do come. But then what they will appreciate is to have, you know, a body that they can deal with. In this case, that's what I was talking about, this Meteorological Association of South Africa. It's something that Chester, and I would like you to take up as a mandate to your counterparts in the Senate, because surely if we don't have any political, you know, buying something that we find is our directory or the country, that they don't have that support. We at the technical level of it, you know, we do cooperate in a lot of things, but then we can only do as much as we can. But then if there's no power that comes from the political world, that nothing can happen really. I think that's to a large extent, if you can get that. I mean, just to get this body to run, to get this mass, it's got a lot of spin-offs that will also help us in moving this, selling our instruments, because we have to look at the benefits for South Africa as well. Because if we get that body running, we can start selling our instrument. And because we can get funding elsewhere. So it's got other spin-offs for us as well. So with that, I'll really say, please, let's put this body to be formed within the SADC structure and be supported there. Okay.
Maybe as we conclude this particular presentation, we'd like to really ask your good office to maybe develop a name for us that will tease out very clearly what are the issues that we should sensitize and raise with our counterparts as we move around the region. Okay. Could we then invite the second... okay, madam.
But what I want to know, I still want to know, is our marine resources can prevent disasters, because sometimes they do happen near the sea, and you'll find that there are mountains and mountains of fish. But can they? Do they? I'd not hear that answer, please. Thank you.
Thank you, madam. Sorry, my apologies also for. Can we get an answer on that question about the marine life?
And she was wide awake, by the way.
What is the impact of flooding on the marine systems?
Chair, thank you very much, and apologies for missing that one. It's written down here, but I missed it. Once again, I'm not an oceanographer, so I think one needs to have those people to really come up with a detail of that. But essentially, the impact of flooding on marines, particularly rainfall on marine resources, will not be much. Weather systems will impact in terms of wave generation, and that might cause the kind of damage that we saw on the east coast in the Devon area, because
of the wave generation that followed from the heavy winds, or the strong winds that, that have developed these waves. From that perspective, yes, there will be impact, and that is more more from the wind aspect of the ocean, but the rain itself should not damage the marine resource as such. That is my personal opinion on this kind of thing. But I think that the subsequent effects of waves, that is the, that's the damaging part of this whole thing.
Maybe we can continue with the exchange also, as we have, I think we have a free lunch. As we offer to commodified lunch later. Can we invite the other presentation?
On Ernest Brunk, that is going to share with us the monitoring that has been taking place at our Cape Town station.
We do have, we're running quite behind schedule, so if you could cooperate with us, we'll hopefully be through here by 1:15 at the latest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, honorable members. It gives me great pleasure to say something about the Cape Point Global Atmosphere Watch Research and Monitoring Program. I've divided my talk into a couple of points. Why do we measure atmospheric parameters? Then I would like to say something about the atmosphere, the environmental importance of trace gases, the actual Cape Point GOR program, some trace gas trends and their climatic relevance, international collaboration and expansion of the program, data quality, and also say something about recent interest in carbon sink strength in the southern oceans, and then conclude. Our atmosphere is a very delicately balanced system, and its energy comes from the sun. So the whole atmosphere system, the energy heat balance is what it's all about, and over the past 150 years this energy heat balance has been somewhat disturbed. The main reason is that the Earth is surrounded by a blanket, greenhouse gases, and they in fact also to a large extent maintain and manage this energy balance. Now the air that we breathe comprises 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, and only 0.1% actually constitutes what we call trace gases. And it's these trace gases that really have a profound influence on our energy balance in the atmosphere and on climate as such. Carbon dioxide is one of the main greenhouse gases, methane the second most important one. The greenhouse effect in itself is actually a very good thing, otherwise we would be freezing down here on Earth. But with industrialization, man has actually, and still is, emitting more gases than are actually good in maintaining the temperature. We are getting atmospheric temperature rise too quickly. And the increased production of greenhouse gases can be related to man's impact on the environment, especially the burning of fossil fuels, land change uses, and so on. And we see, if we look at this graph down here, that over the last 150 years, these so-called greenhouse gases have really increased dramatically. Now, coinciding with the increase of these gases, the average global temperature
has also gone up, which we can see here. In fact, the last 11 to 12 years were the warmest on record. Now, closer home, the South African Weather Service has also done some data analysis and found that within our local context, Southern Africa, there has been a general increase in temperatures. Furthermore, as you have temperature increase, global warming, this also leads to warming of the oceans and thermal expansion. And sea level rise is also something that we have to deal with. The melting of the ice caps, that is not the first and foremost danger. It's more the thermal expansion of the oceans at the moment, which are leading to sea level rise. And low level areas around the world are especially threatened by that.
Thermal expansion. What is thermal expansion?
Oh. Thermal expansion is just as the ocean water gets warmer, it occupies a larger volume. And in doing so, the sea level actually comes up. It rises. Now, as we have also heard by the previous speaker, global warming leads also to changing rainfall patterns globally, and also an increase in extreme events. Furthermore, if you have flooding, you also have an increase in diseases, and all in all, it can also lead to reduced crop rates. So there are many aspects, many negative impacts that follow out of climate change. And this is one of, I think that is the main reason that the World Meteorological Organization has taken the initiative to coordinate a network of so-called global atmosphere watch stations around the globe to measure important environmental parameters very accurately on a long-term basis. South Africa has got Cape Point, which is fills a very important gap in the chain of stations. At the moment, there are about 24. Now there are 24 stations. And due to the importance...
In the world. 24 stations in the world.
There are 24 so-called global atmosphere watch stations in the world. The network is still growing, so maybe next year we'll have 25. But at present, there are 24. Cape Point has now been running for 30 years, and the importance of the data forthcoming from the station has led to increased international collaboration and interest in the data. I will not mention all the organizations and how they cooperate with us, but you can just see there is a whole list of them. 2 years ago, we started a new little project at Cape Point, i.e. the measurement of atmospheric aerosols. Aerosols are dust particles in the atmosphere, and this is something which we are doing with NOAA in America. And these here are chemical filters where we are measuring the chemical composition of the dust in the atmosphere, and this is being done in cooperation with a French research institute in Paris. Besides Cape Point, the Weather Service maintains a regional network of Global Atmosphere Watch activities at Springbok and at Irene, for instance. We have equipment to measure the column ozone from the surface up into the stratosphere, and this is important information as the destruction of ozone is healing. We expect to be able to see that in the data as well. The southern hemisphere has the advantage that we will be able to detect this healing before the northern hemisphere. We also have a network of UVB stations where ultraviolet light is being measured. That is also a consequence of ozone depletion, that the hazardous levels of ultraviolet radiation are high. They in fact have gone up somewhat, and especially during the summer months, the Weather Service also issues regular bulletins on the UV levels. In 2002, we extended our activities also to Antarctica, to SANAI 4, and started with surface ozone measurements. In December 2005, we also added some equipment for column ozone. But let's focus our attention more on Cape Point and what we are actually doing at Cape Point. And I would like to extend an invitation to all of you, if you happen to come to Cape Point. This is where we are situated. This is our laboratory. That's a view of parts of the inside of the laboratory. This mast here also belongs to the total infrastructure. The reason why 30 years ago we decided on putting up a station at Cape Point is that for most of the time we are seeing the air masses that come from the southern and southwestern Atlantic. In other words, we are making measurements in the global atmosphere and not specifically in air masses that come directly from Cape Town, although we also do that. We look at both aspects, but for in terms of the global research, the data that the international community is after is the data that we find in air masses that have not recently been in contact with any local industrial sources. Just to focus again, these are the important greenhouse gases that we do measure at Cape Point, and carbon dioxide being the most important one, I can say, the most well known also. Just listing the type of man-made sources that you can see here. And as human population grows, the atmosphere gets loaded with carbon dioxide. When we started at Cape Point, we were down here at 355, now we are about at 380 parts per million. So the trend is rising. This graph here shows the growth rates, the annual growth rate, and it fluctuates between 1.5 and 2 parts per million, and the growth rate as such is also going up. So when I show that to people, people sometimes get a little shocked to see how the actual atmosphere is changing, and this is not just what we are seeing at Cape Point, this is what the other global atmosphere watch stations are also seeing. Now, fortunately, about half of the emitted carbon gets taken up by the world's oceans, and until recently, the Southern Ocean was believed, and it's still being investigated, as being a very important sink taking up carbon dioxide. Now, recent studies have shown that the ability of the Southern Ocean to take up carbon dioxide has actually been curtailed. It's not able to take up as much CO2 as it used to. So there is a decrease in the ability of the Southern Ocean to take up CO2, and there's been renewed interest to take a look at the Southern Ocean and do further tests. An American research group at Princeton University will, at the beginning of next next month, bring equipment to measure oxygen at Cape Points, and this will also help to understand the CO2 sink of the Southern Ocean much better. Now, after CO2, methane is the second most important greenhouse gas, and methane, again, like CO2, is linked to increased human global activity. For example, increase in rice production, cattle, and wetlands, and also fossil fuel production, all add up to raise the levels of methane in the atmosphere. Methane we've already started to measure in 1983 at Cape Point, and you can see the trend has been going up. Here it's leveled out somewhat. People, when you see that, oh, it's good news, we're now reaching a flat. But scientists who work on the methane problem say that this is only going to be a short-term effect, and that we'll probably in a few years have it going up again. Nitrous oxide, also being emitted by fertilizers and other industrial processes, is another important greenhouse gas, and again, for that there is also no real sign of abating. On the more positive side are the CFCs that are implicated with ozone depletion as a result of the chlorine that they release up in the stratosphere. The Montreal Protocol, of which South Africa is also signatory in 1987, is really a success story, because we have found, and it's been shown elsewhere globally, that Freon 11, which was used in spray cans, and Freon 12 in refrigeration, they are actually leveling off and coming down. Methyl chloroform, which has a shorter lifetime, is really coming down very nicely. However, these gases still need to be monitored, because we are not quite sure what is going to happen in China and other developing countries. There are also so-called replacement gases which have not got such an influence on the stratosphere, but still, they still pose a danger to the ozone. So they need to be monitored, but all in all, mathematical modeling shows that in probably 50 years, if these trends continue, we could possibly also see a healing of the ozone hole over Antarctica. The measurements that we take at Cape Point are being audited on a regular basis. For a couple of gases, there is a Swiss research group that comes to the various Global Atmosphere Watch stations, and they perform scientific audits. For other equipment, like the aerosols, there is a group in Leipzig, Germany. They came out earlier this year. And in this way, the World Meteorological Organization, which coordinates the Global Atmosphere Watch program, and make sure that the data that is being produced is intercomparable between the various stations. Now, the data does not just reside at the Global Atmosphere Watch sites. The data gets submitted to the world data centers. For example, Tokyo is a world data center for greenhouse gases, and this data is then available to the scientific community. It's available to the policy makers. Incidentally, this diagram here is a compilation of CO2 from the various GOR stations, which people call a flying carpet. So you have your time axis here, northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, and concentration here. So you get a global picture of what happens to carbon dioxide. So as I've been saying, the policy makers heavily rely on the data forthcoming from GOR stations. For example, the meeting at Kyoto, where one wants to know what is happening to the atmosphere, what is the impact of our activities. It can only be substantiated with data that we so meticulously collect. Also, the International Panel for Climate Change relies on this data. And so there have been international actions. Some countries have not played the game, but the general message to take home is that we need to reduce the greenhouse emissions, and that we must try also and phase out activities that negatively impact on our planet. On the national front, I'm glad to say that there is new South African legislation in place, and also there's an enormous awareness amongst the formal and private sectors that air quality management in Southern Africa especially is very important, because we also need to look at the national emissions. We are four people involved at the Cape Point station. Besides managing the equipment, collecting the data, we also maintain a little visitor center at Cape Point, and at times we also invite scholars and students from universities and schools, and we try and give them an insight into what we are doing and the relevance of greenhouse gases to climate change. In summary, I just want to highlight these points again and to say that Cape Point fulfills a very pivotal role locally and internationally, and to some extent also acts as an early warning system, because we are watching the trace gas components in the atmosphere and how they are changing. The trace gas data forthcoming from the station contributes largely towards a better understanding of climate change. And this work, and also the regional activities of the Weather Service, I think go a long way to satisfy the international commitments that we as a country have to protect our planet. The measurements that we've taken so far on the whole agree with other sites, and they show that the greenhouse gases, notably CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide, are on the increase. On the more positive side, the stratospheric ozone depleting gases such as CFCs are declining, which is a good thing. Hopefully it will remain like that. And our program
is expanding, and we also envisage to add some other important parameters such as aerosol optical depth, which is a parameter to measure the dust loading in the atmosphere, the whole column, and then also specialized oxygen measurements, which will start next month. All in all, the international collaboration that we have is increasing, and I can see that the importance of Cape Point has been recognized, and this is why there is more and more interest by other research institutes to collaborate with us and to also have cooperative programs. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to conclude.
Thank you very much, Dr. Punker. Could you invite the professor now?
Yeah.
Portfolio committee members, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to talk on carbon capture and storage, which is also known as carbon sequestration. It's quite a very technical subject, and it's at a stage of infancy in most parts of the world. Carbon sequestration is an approach to mitigating global warming by capturing CO2 from large point sources such as power plants and ultimately storing it instead of releasing it into the atmosphere. Technology is there for capturing CO2. But storage is still something at a stage of development. There are various methods that have been conceived for storing CO2. These are the main sources of stationary sources of CO2 in the world. This was a study that was conducted on a number of stations, the major one being power generation plants, cement refineries, and others. There are various forms that have been conceived for permanent storage of CO2, and these include storage in geological formations, such as saline formations and exhausted gas fields, storage in oceans, as well as in the production of stable carbonates. Geosequestration or geological storage of CO2 involves the injection of CO2 directly into underground geological formations, oil fields and gas fields, saline formations, unminable coal seams, and saline fields. Saline formations have been suggested as storage sites for CO2. But these structures must be physically fit for trapping the escape or the leakage of CO2 from the geological formations. CO2 is sometimes injected into declining oil fields to increase oil refinery, what is known as enhanced oil refinery. This option is attractive because the storage costs, the costs that are incurred
during CCS are offset by the sale of additional oil, which is recovered when you pump CO2 to inject the oil from the geological formations. Various forms have been conceived for permanent storage of CO2. These forms include gaseous storage in various geological formations, as well as to produce stable carbonates. The IPCC estimates that CO2 could be trapped for millions of years in these geological formations, and these sites are likely to retain over 99% of the injected CO2 over 1,000 years. Another option is ocean storage, and here there are two concepts to distinguish: the dissolution type storage and lake type storage. Dissolution type storage involves the injection of CO2 by a ship or pipeline into a water column at about 1 kilometer depth in the sea, where it will subsequently dissolve. The lake type deposit involves depositing CO2 at depths of about 3 kilometers, 300 meters, 3,000 meters or more, where CO2 by laws of thermodynamics and hydrodynamics becomes denser and it settles to the ground, and it will there will be a delayed effect on the dissolution effect of CO2 in that environment. The figure there depicts the two types of storages at sea. The dissolution type at about 1 kilometer from the ground, which can be done through a fixed pipeline from a plant bed down into the sea, or using a ship which injects your CO2 into that zone, where it will over time be subjected to the dissolution effect, or the lake type dissolution at sea through a platform, pumping your CO2 down the pipe to settle there at the bottom of the sea. That's a lake type dissolution of CO2. Again, the IPCC says CFCs, when applied to modern conventional power plants, could reduce CO2 emissions to the atmosphere by between 80% and 90% compared to a plant without carbon sequestration. Capturing and compressing CO2 requires much energy and would increase the fuel needs of a plant with CCS by about 10% to 40%, and of course there are other added costs like the scrubbers that must be installed, as well as CO2 compressors that must be installed at the plant for effective capture of CO2. The global formations that are currently considered for sequestration of CO2, global formations are more promising currently, and they are estimated to have a storage capacity of at least 2,000 gigatons CO2, and the IPCC argues that carbon sequestration could contribute between 10% and 55% of the total mitigation effort until the year 2010. This diagram summarizes nicely the different types of geological methods for storage of CO2. The first one there is depleted oil and gas reserves. Pumping your CO2 directly into the geological formation. Second one is use of CO2 in enhanced oil and gas recovery. The key there explains the reddish parts are produced oil or gas, injected CO2 and stored CO2.
So when you inject the O2 into the geological formation there, it helps at the same time to recover hot, in the sense that you get oil or gas being ejected out into the top surface, or let me say you recover your oil or gas from the very same formation as a result of the pushing effect of the O2 within the geological formation there. So you recover the cost as a result thereof. Option number three are saline formations, and that is offshore, and that one is onshore. And the fourth one, also you can have cost recovery there when you inject CO2 into your geological formation, and at the same time methane is recovered, which can be used as an alternative source of energy. Under an integrated system, energy system, you can have a very effective way of storing CO2. This is one example where you have a plant over there using natural gas, using natural gas from the geological formation and injecting CO2 into the geological formation, and the gas is taken to that integrated energy grid consisting of, the diagram is not very, very clear, oil, your oil reserves, biomass, coal, what's the other one? Yeah. Some of your types of your energy sources that go into that integrated energy source. And all of this through such technical processes as post-combustion processes or pre-combustion processes or off-fuel combustion processes, you are able to separate CO2 from your product, so that it is ejected either through mineral carbonation, it is stored, or through your carbon sequestration in geological formations, or you deposit it into the sea as late tide or the liquid type of sequestration at sea that I presented earlier. This is one practical example in the UK. They pump oil from the North Sea into natural gas from the North Sea into the plants to feed your UK gas grid. So this structure operates within the framework of the previous sketch. The gas goes into the UK gas grid. Other part goes into that reformer carbon capture system there, where CO2 is separated, it goes into deposition at sea, and at the same time you get oil being produced to feed into your grid system. I'm not going to dwell into this diagram because of time. The previous speaker did speak about CO2 concentrations increasing in the atmosphere, and of course the relationship between temperature and CO2 in the atmosphere. What has been observed is the relationship between CO2 increase and the acidification of the ocean, as depicted here from 1750 to 1750, projected up to 3000. There is a tendency for, as carbon dioxide increases, there is a tendency for the pH at sea, your global ocean, dropping, becoming more acidic. That is one problem we might be encountering with our efforts towards carbon sequestration, the acidification of our marine. Again here, it's a depiction of what has been happening. CO2 has been increasing since pre-industrial times. That's your time scale there, that's your pH on the Y. The pH has been dropping over time, whilst at the same time carbon dioxide concentrations have been increasing. The decrease so far has been estimated at a magnitude of 0.1, on a pH scale, and it's projected that by the year 2050 we will experience at current growth rate, we'll experience pH values of about 7.8 compared to 8.2 from where we're coming from. We're going to get the world ocean becoming more acidic. The capturing and compressing of CO2 requires much energy, significantly raising the running cost of CCS equipment, equipped power plants. In addition, there are investment and capital costs that I've mentioned before to do with your scrubbers, as well as CO2 compressors prior to storage. Of course, storage and transportation costs are other added costs. The process would increase the energy need of the plants by between 10% and 40%, but the overall effect is a positive one, according to the IPCC report, in the sense that we have a decreased concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere. The cost of storage and other system costs are estimated to increase the cost of energy from a power plant with CCS by 30 to 60% relative to a non-CCS plant. This diagram summarizes very nicely the last point there. This is your reference station, your non-CCS station, a station that doesn't practice carbon sequestration. The plants with CCS will have relatively more emissions because of more energy demand from carbon capture and storage, but not all of the CO2 is released into the atmosphere. It gets captured, so that the amount that is captured as depicted here is from here to there, and this is only that little portion, say about 10%, that will escape into the atmosphere. And it's estimated that the CCS will cost the global economy 2% in terms of the global GDP, global domestic product. And of course, developing countries will be hard hit unless there is exchange of technology somehow. The transport of CO2, if I can just summarize this slide very quickly, looking at time. Pipeline is suggested to be the most feasible way of transporting CO2 for ultimate disposal or storage, as well as ships. But if the CO2 is dry, there is less likelihood for rusting of pipes to occur. The environmental effects have not yet been fully investigated. However, preliminary findings are indicating that large concentration of CO2 will kill your ocean organisms. And there is a likelihood of leakage of CO2 into the atmosphere again when your ocean and your atmosphere equilibrate. Also, as part of the CO2 reacts with water to form carbonic acid, you are going to see your ocean water pH becoming more acidic, and that will put a lot of pressure on your marine life forms, a very, very fragile ecosystem. These are estimates that the cost for deep ocean disposal of liquid CO2 is estimated at between $40 and $80 by 2002 US dollar rates. Leakage is a serious problem if the geological features of prior to disposal are not considered carefully. It's a major problem when there's leakage of the stored CO2, that will ultimately defeat the aim of curbing climate change. However, for well-selected, designed and managed geological storage sites, IPCC estimates that CO2 will be trapped for millions of years and are likely to retain over 99% of the injected CO2 over 1,000 years. For ocean storage, the retention of CO2 will depend on the depth of storage, and of course, lake disposal will ensure a higher storage level than your disposal at 1 kilometer depth. IPCC also estimates 30 to 85% will be retained. CO2 will be retained where it is, where it was stored after 500 years for depth of between 1,000 and 3,000 meters. Mineral leakage is not regarded as having any risk of leakage, provided the geological criteria are very stringent. This is one successful example, according to one author, summarized in those words, of a project, a CCS project in Norway, which has been operational. It is the oldest, actually, started in 1996, and there hasn't been any side effects since then. So it's one of the successful projects from which the other nations can learn. The Sleipner project in Norway started in 1996, located in the North Sea. It strips carbon dioxide from the natural gas with amine solvents, and it disposes your carbon dioxide in a saline environment. And in that way, there's a lot of cost recovery. This is a picture of the operation of Statsol in Norway. It injects CO2 into the saltwater aquifers beneath the sea floor of the Norwegian coast. The project turns up a profit due to the presence of Norway's high carbon taxes. So there is a save somehow in that regard. Here's another example from Canada that will inject something like 1.5 million tons per annum of CO2 into the geological formation. Another one is in Nigeria. This one appears to be at a very early stage of infancy. It's said to have a potential of injecting 1.2 million tons of CO2 into the geological formation. The U.S. is also coming up with what is called future gen as a project which it claims will be the world's first CCS power plant. There's another one in Netherlands, and there's a lot of research work that is going on in Australia. Now, the framework we are operating in is this one. Increased carbon dioxide will result in increased net temperatures in the atmosphere, raising your thermometer. There's another scenario, a debate that was raging in the 90s as well as early 2000s, but at the moment there seems to be an agreement among scientists that global climate change is something that is happening, it is real. Scenario number two was a group of scientists who were saying, okay, if there is global climate change, it's okay. You are ultimately going to get, at the end of the day, a negative feedback through enhanced CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. Your large CO2 concentration in the atmosphere will result in the blooming of trees, in your enhanced growth of trees, absorbing CO2 during the process of photosynthesis, and in the process you'll end up with lower temperatures. But there is consensus among scientists that this is the way to go. This is the framework that is adopted in this CCS strategy. Vegetation is another source for storage, natural source for storage of carbon in the atmosphere. It's mainly located in your tropical forests, as well as your boreal forests, and less storage happens in temperate forests and tropical savannas. Let me rush through this. One, regarding leachates, the threat will be with regard to asphyxiation, suffocation due to carbon dioxide displacing oxygen. It's a likelihood, again, if there is leakage from your geological formations, and that needs to be taken into account. Contamination of drinking water is also a likelihood, and that might result in the leaching of toxic chemicals such as your heavy metals like lead from rocks, putting a lot of strain on our purification plants, and because if not, lead being a heavy metal tends to accumulate up in the food chain. So there needs to be a careful selection of places that will not leak, and doing a good engineering job, injecting, developing your injection systems, and paying attention to where carbon dioxide is actually going to be required. We need a family of solutions. We know that carbon sequestration is one such technology. But critics of carbon sequestration are saying this will divert the attention from you know, us pursuing long-term energy options and delaying our whole efforts into long-term energy options, because there is now this quick fix solution. The worst fear, they fear it will prolong fossil fuel use if fossil fuel conventional sources can be used more cleanly. Continual emphasis on the need to adopt other technologies need to be emphasized. Geological sequestration should be seen as one of those family of solutions, and as a bridge technology. An overview to this, carbon capture and storage in geological formations is technically feasible, though financially taxing. CCS potentially offers carbon emission reductions at costs similar to offshore wind and nuclear energy or alternative energy sources, according to IPCC. Enhanced oil recovery in the North Sea and other regions will serve as a lesson to us. And under present economic conditions, CCS may not be financially viable. Creating incentives for CCS forms part of the wider debate, like it's been done in the UK, for instance. Incentives have already been made. CCS could play a role in reducing future emissions from developing countries like ours. I need to acknowledge these references as sources for most of what has been presented here. On that note, I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dube. With the first traditions of the Dube family, you are really leading us into the 21st century. As you led us in the deformation of the ALC. Could we welcome some comments?
Unfortunately, that such a very good technical
keep it short
explanation is coming at the end. I would have loved it in the audience to be fresh. But I just want to say, Dr. Dube, the CDM, the carbon development mechanism, how could you just comment on it? Because there was such a big hype about it that the CDM is going to be, it will be put up in order that third world countries, the carbon development mechanism, third world countries can pollute, they can emit, etc., etc.
and then those that are not emitting, which are the less vulnerable countries, will be paid and will be given money in for behaving properly. In other words, not contributing carbon to emit, clean like the gas gases, to cause more pollution. Can you just factor that CDM into your presentation to contextualize in respect of global warming?
We're going to have some sort of a briefing on carbon trading at some stage as well, because I think that is crucial at this time, and I think it's quite a debatable topic. Isn't there something one can do with carbon dioxide? Is there any sort of research being done? I mean, it's being emitted in such huge quantities. Surely there's some creative scientific way of using it, making use of it in some way. That's the one thing. And I just also wondered, in terms of our national legislation and our Air Quality Act, and I think South Africa is doing a lot in terms of the appropriate national legislation, and I think we also need to find out what the other countries in SADC are doing, what their national legislation, not necessarily that they would have the capacity to implement it. I mean, it's a challenge for us too, but I think we need to find out what the SADC countries are thinking is in terms of appropriate legislation to contain the emissions that are a huge global challenge at the moment. Thank you.
Chairperson, on this presentation, the process that was mentioned that happened within the seawater and raises the sea level. We've got two oceans here. What is the balance between the two? Is it the same? And again, with the very same ocean, we do swim. What implications does it have to our life? And one other, the last one, with the greenhouse emissions that we have right now, how do we view the key points in the long run? Maybe 2015, 2020, from now on, is it going to go down, is it going to go up?
Thank you. Just two questions. I think we will have to try and find some time. I know that we invite you again to the professor to come and talk to us with more time. We will reserve the whole morning to your presentation so that we can go into the details of these issues far more deeply than we are doing right now. I would like to ask you this one question. This two. One is between carbon dioxide waste and nuclear waste, which is more dangerous? Which is more dangerous? And therefore for our country, which would be more likely, safer route for us to pursue? Because it would seem that the cost of sequestration are equivalent, but I suspect they're probably cheaper than those of quota to nuclear companies. And secondly, we were of the view that wanted to visit an Anglo-American plant in Australia that we are aware is more advanced. I don't know the name of the company, but we asked the parliamentary researcher to look for it for us. Should we go to Australia, or would we be better off going to the north, to England, the Nordic countries, where they seem to be more advanced, or at least they seem to be equally advanced, and therefore offer more diverse experiences for us to learn? We want to look at these things and we should speak in the country around this question. I think we'll end it there.
Okay, thank you. Maybe I can start with that one, Honorable Chair. There's a lot of development in Europe, especially in Norway and England. Yes, Australia is doing something in as far as looking at CCS. The literature I went to mainly highlights successes in the north.
This one doesn't know during cold, because I think the attraction of Australia to us was the cold sequences, was the sequential system based on cold. That was part of our success, because we are a cold producing country. Mm. If you could comment on that, sort of what they say.
These were oil and gas plants. I wouldn't, Mr. Honorable Chair, because the plan has been made already to go to Australia. A lot of work is happening in Australia. I would say carry on with your visit to Australia and maybe do a later comparative analysis with another visit to the north. The other question on CO2 and nuclear waste. I don't know if I'll be able to handle this one quite very well. It's South Africa has got large reserves of uranium and nuclear energy. I'm not quite sure there whether you're talking in terms of energy. You compared CO2 waste and nuclear waste.
The debate in the country right now is that the police of the government wants to go on a nuclear road. But the debate, and no one else can answer it, is the government. It's what you do with the waste. Okay? Now, the problem with the waste is that it's dangerous. That it will still have potential for explosion over the next million years if any terrorist goes there and does a trick or something. Now, that's more riskier in terms of waste than this one, the waste of CO2, which is most dangerous. Because the one has the environmental impact, which is the slow death. The other one, the immediate death. How would you advise us on this matter?
Well, I would say they both need effective management and monitoring. If you look at sites that are set to be good in South Africa or fit for carbon dioxide sequestration, it's mainly on the western sections of the country. Excuse me? Unfortunately. That is what the IPCC report depicts for South Africa as ideal site for your geological sequestration of CO2. Talks are also led with nuclear waste. It's unfortunately also pointing in your direction. but with effective management and monitoring of these waste sites, I'm sure we can move some strides in that direction. With regard to swimming implications to our lives, I don't know if that question was directed to me. Yes, there will be acidification of oceans, but it's not going to be something which is immediate. A pH of 7.2 is within the acceptable limits. We are not here talking about pH values which are really very, very low. pH levels of 2 or 3, that would be very, very dangerous to your skin and health. So in terms of swimming, even though there would be acidification of lakes due to the formation of carbonic acid and other things, it's not going to be something immediate. It's something that's going to take a very, very long time. There was another question on the FADC. What is FADC? What is it doing to contain emissions? Did I get that right?
any project around Australia.
Pardon?
And but does static thinking, the other countries, being in any way focused on appropriate legislation such as our Air Quality Act in order to contain emissions?
Not that I know of. Perhaps because most of the problem to do with air quality in Africa as a developing country is more of biomass burning. South Africa is perhaps the only culprit with regard to other you know, your very serious sources of pollution. Is there anything that could be done with CO2? Oh, it was a comment. Okay. Not that I know of. I know it as waste. With regard to the first two questions on carbon dioxide development mechanisms and carbon trading, which I think are interrelated, I can maybe emphasize that at some stage in the early 80s, there was this notion that we can deal with the problem of climate change by planting trees. And this was done mostly in developing countries, were encouraged to do that. And with new technological advancement, we are now seeing other options of dealing with the notion of climate change, such as your carbon sequestration. As I presented in my presentation, that we should see CCS as one of the family of options that are available to us to deal with global climate change. Sampesia, I think you had something to say with the CBM.
You wanted to say something, 1 second.
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. It's in view with legislation. One wonders, since we have common objectives in the SADC community, wouldn't it make sense when it comes to things such as, you know, legislation that has to do with air quality, we should have common legislation within the SADC community so that at least, you know, you don't have anybody coming up with something contrary to what you're doing.
Yes, I would agree with that. But specifically, again, we need to think along the notion of carbon sequestration if you are to go that route. That currently, your mining legislation dictates or deals with the extraction of a resource and not the injection of a resource into a geological formation. So we need to come up with guidelines, expand or review our mineral resources if we go that route, as to what are the processes and procedures for carbon sequestration, what quantities are allowable in our geological formation. I would support a common objective within the SADC, because if you deal with a question of air pollution, it's you know, your air pollutants do not respect political boundaries, unlike us as human beings. So it's something that needs to be dealt with in a holistic manner. I would support that. And I don't know if this will form part of what Dr. Mpefia suggested with regard to MASA, if this can be taken together with this, what you call a body of the SADC.
Let me just come in on what you've just alluded here on a common legislation. for me, one needs to start at looking what are the sources. If we look at the sources, they are different from all the countries. I mean, South African sources, I mean, your power stations, which are the hubs that produce a lot of your SO2, carbon dioxide. And if you look at other parts of set of countries, Zambia, the copper mines, you know, you've got a lot of, you know, those mines that emit your SO2. So if you look at Mozambique, you know, you don't have similar sources. So then you can have a similar approach, different sources. So you'll have a challenge there, just starting with that. For me now, if South Africa, if we look at our legislation more, my concern is around the transboundary transport of pollutants. Because we all know that, yes, we do have all the power stations situated in Highveld, in Mpumalanga Highveld. Surely those the emissions coming from those techs, we know that they are emitting above the invasion area. And what happened to those pollution? What goes up must come down. It's just a system. One needs to know where is that pollution, where is it landing, what impact does it have? If it's not having any impact today, when can we have the likelihood impact? So then you're talking about now the issue of regional. You're not only talking only South Africa. You're talking about, because now what's going to happen maybe in few years' time, people will be saying, hey, we used to have maize. Our yields used to be like this. But then because of the impact coming from South Africa, that has an impact on us. Are we prepared, or are there any institutions within South Africa that's looking into those issues? But our air quality is only looking at the impact of health and not looking at the impact of your soil yield, your crop yield, and those could be things that will be connoting sooner or later. So for me, when you talk about legislation, that's looking at that. I would rather say as South African community approaching and looking at this.
Looking at the CDM, obviously one will hope that a project like this, which looks at capturing and reducing the CO2 content in the atmosphere, could be one of the best projects that one could look into. But like I've indicated, that it's an area that, as South African Weather Service, we're not playing in. I think Department of Mineral Energy will be the best to talk to. Moreover, they have a department, they've set up a department that looks into the CDMs and what. So I'll really urge and suggest that maybe if it's still possible before your visit, you could just get them to, you know, give a 1-hour presentation as well to get a feel of what's happening in this area.
I mean, that question relating to the emission in SADC and what are they doing?
There isn't much that I know that's happening in SADC on looking at mitigation or reducing the CO2 emissions that I know of. What I used to know that we had a project when I used to work for ESCOM some years ago that we encouraged SADC countries to come in, and we did have money, research money, to say they need to look into projects that are related to climate change. One of them that I was overlooking was to look at the impact of climate change in the hydro potential generation of electricity. So there are those sort of studies, but then not into the mitigation part of it. And on the air quality, obviously, my colleague has already alluded that it's different sources. And then you'll the other challenges in other parts is that it's lead coming from the motor car, old motor cars. That is their challenge. Not like us, maybe somehow maybe we've moved forward with that.
Around the issue of pay points, whether it's going to come to an end or what, please dissolve.
I hope that in 20 years Cape Point will still be around. Internationally, there is a need for more and better measurements rather than to scale down on measurements. If we want to understand the complex system of the atmosphere, we need to really measure. The Americans started to measure CO2 at Mauna Loa in 1958, and it's now a very famous record, and they will certainly continue with that. What I didn't mention was that we are measuring carbon monoxide at Cape Horn. We've got the longest record of carbon monoxide. Carbon monoxide is a reactive gas, not a greenhouse gas, but it tells you something about the oxidizing capacity of the atmosphere. So we need to know whether the atmosphere in future still has this ability to cleanse itself. At the moment, the carbon monoxide record at Cape Point shows that the levels have remained fairly constant, which means the atmosphere is still able to cleanse itself. So I would say definitely we should continue and possibly also expand on accurate monitoring programs.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been a long morning, but very useful. It certainly has helped us to prepare well for the trip that we're planning to Southern Africa as well as to Australia. With that, thank you very much. The portfolio committee is adjourned. The free lunch that we're offering to everyone. Thank you.